and join Oliver Arnolds as you wind down in the evening with ultimate calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sound.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 9th of November. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. The former Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has partly blamed President Biden for the Democrats' bruising election defeat, suggesting they would have fared better if he'd pulled out of the race sooner. Ms. Pelosi is said to have played a key role in persuading Mr. Biden to end his re-election bid, but she told the New York Times her party could have used more time to choose his replacement. Samira Hussain reports from Washington.
Now that the election is over, the recriminations have begun in the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House, and one of the most influential people in the party, largely blamed U.S. President Joe Biden for the Democrats' crushing defeat. In an interview with the New York Times, Ms. Pelosi said, had he stepped aside earlier, there could have been other candidates in the race. As Democrats lick their wounds, Republicans are on the verge of a clean sweep, already winning the presidency and control of the Senate. They are just 6 votes shy of winning the House of Representatives.
Iran has rejected American claims that it recruited a man to assassinate Donald Trump. The U.S. Justice Department has charged Farah Chakeri, who it says told police he was instructed to kill the president-elect last month. He allegedly said that the plan would be easier to carry out after the election, believing Mr. Trump would not win. Mr. Chakeri is now believed to be in Iran. A UK-based DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading without telling its customers, raising concerns about what's happened to their data. Atlas Biomed used saliva samples to profile people's unique genetic makeup, but its website no longer works, and the firm's last update on social media was over a year ago. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Atlas Biomed's accounts are long overdue, according to Companies House, but the firm is still listed as being active. It has 2 public addresses in London, which the BBC visited. One had never heard of the DNA testing company. The second was home to the firm which registered it, but not Atlas Biomed itself. 2 of its remaining offices share an address in Moscow, according to their filings, along with a third man, a major shareholder, who is also a Russian billionaire. The data watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, confirmed that it had received a complaint about the company.
Police in Pakistan say at least 17 people have been killed in a powerful explosion at a railway station in the southwestern city of Quetta. No group has claimed responsibility for the blast. The province of Balochistan is home to several separatist groups who accuse the central government of exploiting the resource-rich province. The Metropolitan Police has denied claims that farmers have been banned from protesting in London about government plans to remove an exemption from inheritance tax for some. Farmers and their supporters claimed they'd been prevented from holding a rally on November the 19th because of what they called two-tier policing, which favoured pro-Palestinian protests. But Scotland Yard said it would work with anyone who wanted to protest peacefully. A campaign group is urging hundreds of thousands of former university students to check if they're eligible for a refund from the student loans company. Figures show a total of £184 million has been overpaid and could be claimed back. Martin got a refund of nearly £400.
For the month that I got the refund, obviously it was quite nice to have that. I was on a little trip with my girlfriend in Lincoln, so I had a bit more freedom to spend. But at the same time, it was sort of how much extra money have they been taking off me for the last 10 months or so? Maybe I could have done with just having it when I should have had it, really. But I was definitely pleased to get it back, at least.
More than 30 firefighters, police officers and other public servants who've died in the line of duty have become the first to posthumously receive a new award in recognition of their sacrifice. Among those honoured with the Elizabeth Emblem are PCs Fiona Bone and Nicola Hughes, who were killed in an ambush in 2012. That's the news. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute. But first, Elizabeth Rizzini's here with the weather forecast.
Thank you, Alan. Well, the gloom, the low cloud is just set to continue again for many of us today. Some brighter skies once more across parts of Scotland, some pockets of brightness too across the northwest of England, perhaps, and a little chillier than it has been over the last few days, but certainly very similar indeed. We'll start to see a few more changes tomorrow with some showers and eventually some brighter skies. We're starting off the morning between 5 and 8 degrees. degrees Celsius for many. It's chillier than that across the far north of Scotland, though. We saw some clear spells here through the night. There's some areas of mist and fog over the hills, some patchy drizzle, and some really quite stubborn fog, too, across parts of northwest Scotland this morning. That will lift and clear, and we should see some brighter skies develop here. But elsewhere, it's rather grey, very dreary looking again, and there could be a bit of drizzle, but generally speaking, it's looking largely dry once more. Some brighter skies developing across the far northwest of England, Cumbria, Lancashire, perhaps into northwestern Wales, and certainly some sunshine for Scotland. Temperatures 8 to 10 Celsius for most, but 11 to 14 for Northern Ireland and western Scotland.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Time now for a look at the papers. And The Guardian reports that officials in Kyiv believe relations between the UK and Ukraine have got worse since Labour came to power in July. It notes that Sir Keir Starmer is yet to visit Ukraine since becoming Prime Minister. A senior figure in President Zelensky's administration is quoted as saying a trip would be pointless without Sir Keir committing to replenishing stocks of the sought-after long-range Storm Shadow missile system. There's no point in him coming as a tourist, they add. The government has previously said the UK's support of Ukraine is unwavering. Most of the papers look ahead to a Channel 4 documentary featuring comments from the police marksman who shot dead Jean-Charles Jimenez, the man wrongly suspected of being a terrorist after the 7/7 bombings in London in 2005. He says he'll have to live with what happened for the rest of his life. It's the first time the firearms officer, who's remained anonymous for almost 20 years, has spoken publicly about what happened. Unmasked is the headline in the Daily Mail. The announcement that the Princess of Wales will attend remembrance events across the weekend is marked by most of the papers. Kate soldiers on, says The Sun. The Daily Express says it's a significant step on her gradual return to royal duties. According to The Times, Prince Andrew has raised the funds to be allowed to stay in his home at Royal Lodge on the Windsor Estate. Earlier this year, the prince reportedly received written notice that the king would cut him off financially if he refused to move into more modest accommodation. And the Daily Telegraph says historians are lining up to point out inaccuracies in Ridley Scott's latest film, Gladiator 2. The paper says experts have questioned scenes showing shark-infested waters around a flooded Colosseum and another of a gladiator riding a rhino complete with stirrups and a saddle. But Dan Snow is quoted as saying, even though the depictions are wrong, he thinks it's only proper for artists, filmmakers and writers to be allowed to project fantastical visions of the past. And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4. In half an hour, we'll join Charlotte Smith for Farming Today this week. But first, here's Claire Baldings with this week's ramblings.
I've been looking up facts on autumn leaves. Obviously, the leaves start to get less sunlight, and so the chlorophyll goes down. It breaks down and goes down to the roots, and then the green disappears and the other colours are revealed. So they're kind of always there, it's just you don't see them for the rest of the year until now. Which is, I feel very ignorant that I didn't actually know that before. Andrew, you probably knew that, did you know that?
Shall I say yes?
Andrew Simpkins is my walking guide today, and this route that we're going on is a particular favourite of yours.
Yes, because it's connected, as hopefully we'll, you know, explore later, between various ways that I've walked around the whole coast of England and various borders. And it's a pretty little route between the conurbation of Winchester, and we can hear some of that noise now, and the conurbation of Eastleigh, which is about 6-7 miles to the south. But it's a lovely haven of peace, hopefully, today, down the River Itchen, one of those glorious chalk streams of which we seem to have a monopoly of chalk streams in England.
It's something like 85%, isn't it, of the world's chalk streams are this end of Europe, and most of them in England.
Yeah.
I wonder what the River Itchen, what the name comes from. Funny one, isn't it? Hi there.
Good morning.
Sorry to take up the whole... Who's this?
Oh, this is Puppy.
Hello, Puppy. Hello, sweetheart. There are so many people around. Lots of dog walkers, people out running. Kids are off on half term at the moment, so exploring the muddy slope to the left. And we get our first glimpse of the River Itchen down on the right there. And there is something about a chalk stream. I mean, it always looks so pure and cold. And as we gaze actually across the water meadows towards Winchester, and we see, I mean, you can identify the numbers of trees much more clearly in autumn because they are different colours. So it's not just one big mass of green, but we've got that deep red over there. There must be a couple of copper beeches just round to the right, but also the yellows and the mahogany brown. It's a glorious day, and there's been rain, so it's damp underfoot. So, Andrew, tell me about you, yourself, and your background.
Well, I was brought up in a traditional family in Lichfield, Staffordshire. Looking back, it was a pretty idyllic childhood. I always kept busy doing things, scouts and CCF and climbing and things like that. My father wasn't from a military background, but I was attracted to the army because it gave me that balance of advancement and learning new skills and a bit of physical activity thrown in. And so I applied to go to Sandhurst and went there in 1971, I think.
And do you select a regiment before you go, or do they put you into what they think is the right regiment for you?
I'm not sure what's going on behind the scenes, but I applied for the Royal Artillery and had a fantastic 4 years, and I spent a lot of time in the back of helicopters, and I thought, God, that's good life. So I applied to become an army pilot and went on a pilot's course in 77, I think.
And how did that work out?
I had the chance to look at my flying report some years later, and it said his initial promise evaporated with time.
Oh dear.
Which is a bit disheartening, but it didn't get me thrown out.
No. If you would like to follow us on the map, and I know people do, they like to have a little look at the route. We're on OS Explorer OL32, which is Winchester. Where we started is SU487285. And how far are we walking and where to? Because this is a linear walk, isn't it?
It is, yes. We're going down the Itchin Way, and it's about 6.5 to 7 miles to Eastleigh.
And the drive, the motivation for walking as many miles as you did, sort of 3,000 odd miles, very closely connected with what happened to your daughter, Alice. Tell me about Alice.
Well, Alice was born in 1988. She was a lovely girl, very mature for her age, very wise, perspicacious, and we had a variety of postings around Europe and to America, and she embraced those, and she met the love of her life while she was a teenager, and they went to separate universities, but they still were very close to each other, and they married in 2012.
You talk about Alice in the past tense. What happened?
She started to say that she had various conditions, you know, aches and pains, fatigue, headaches, and eventually she was diagnosed with lupus. Lupus is an autoimmune disease. You can treat it, but Alice used to say that she had flare-ups quite often. And she had a baby in 2016. And during the pregnancy, she was somewhat better. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the baby was born, the conditions came back.
Hey,
this is St. Catherine's, obviously.
As we come out, I'm going on a lovely wide tarmac path, and cyclists coming by us and dog walkers coming towards us. And on the left, rising up in isolation, the hill that is St. Catherine's Hill, it's got this circular copse at the top of it of trees. And to the left of that, I think, is the labyrinth. So it's a twisting, turning path you can walk. It makes you concentrate just on putting one foot in front of the other. And Andrew, as you know very well, that is something that is quite therapeutic.
Well, yes, anything that connects you to nature and lets your mind drift is wonderful. Many of us have found that walking, whether it's short distance or as a long-term project, is a brilliant way of letting the mind free itself up.
And is that part of the reason why you took on a walking challenge?
Yes, I've always walked. It goes back to my teenage years when I used to go to Wales with friends to climb. And if you climb, you have to walk to get to the place you're going to climb, or the mountain, or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, that was in my background. But we lived in the southwest, and I'd always heard of the Southwest Coast Path, and I'd done bits of it. And I thought, well, you know what, I think I'll have a go at that. And it's Minehead, anti-clockwise, through Land's End, along the south coast to past Swanage to Studland Bay. And that was, every time I got home, I used to say, that was glorious. You know, that was better than the last time. And then I looked across at Poole Harbour and I thought, I can't just stop here. I just have to keep going. And so when I had, you know, spare time, I would progressively make my way along the coast. But there was no master plan. I was just using the time to get recreation from walking. But the focus of it came when there was one day Alice contacted me, 2016, and she said, Dad, I've got 2 days of medical appointments. Can you help me out and look after the baby? And I said, yeah, of course, Alice. And when I met her, she said, my back is really hurting. And they discovered that the lupus had screened away the symptoms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which had reached stage four.
And presumably by stage four, there is very limited treatment they can offer.
Well, the human spirit is strong, isn't it? Because we, the close family, and I felt that the nursing staff and the doctors willed Alice on, and they never lost hope. Now, whether they were disguising that, I will never know. And I don't want to know.
The river has widened on the right. There was a section we passed where it was dammed, and then a big, noisy waterfall, and here it stretches out. So it's a good sort of probably 15 metres across and flowing very fast, and it's quite high. We've come under the M3 and the noise of those cars disappearing behind us, and now the sun coming at us and it's really warm. Andrew, you were starting to explain that the motivation behind the walk, or indeed the purpose of the walk, changed from when you started to what happened and what it became.
Yes, I had reached somewhere on the south coast, and then tragically Alice died in late 2016, and it suddenly gave me a purpose, a reason to go walking, because as I've said to people, I walk by myself, but I'm not alone. I'm in the best of company. I'm walking in the memory, you know, of Alice. I don't believe in an afterlife, so the connection I have with Alice is always going to be in this world. And the great thing about a walk is you start it at, you know, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and you're going to walk for 4 or 5 hours. And I don't think about her, obviously, every minute of that walk, but it just allows me to be in that space. And I find that very, very calming, and I feel like I'm paying tribute to her. When Alice passed away in 2016, I started walking in earnest in 2017. We had a bit of a gap because of COVID. And then once COVID has been over, you know, I've covered a lot of grounds because I set myself a target and I discovered it was quite difficult to keep up. So I finished only 2 days ago in Weymouth.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, yes.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you, yes. Well, it was a daylight today. The sun was shining. Family and friends, school friends turned up.
Oh, wow.
Family and friends turned up, and it was glorious. Yeah, I hope it was glorious for everybody, but for me, obviously, it was a culmination.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a way to celebrate her, and particularly her strength of character, because I suspect there were moments when you had to channel your your inner strength when it was, you know?
Well, I think that's one of the biggest challenges for me, because, you know, I come from a military, I was in the military, and, you know, when the chips are down, people talk about, you know, having to show resolve and all that, you know, courage, if you will. And, but when Alice was in hospital, she showed bags of physical courage, because she had to cope with the situation she was in. But she never threw that problem onto other people's shoulders. She contained it within herself. And she also had an inner courage to realise that there was no point dwelling on her situation and projecting it into the room. And as a consequence, the room that she was in for a long time, 5 months, had a certain warmth about it. I mean, call it love if you will. And for that, I'm incredibly proud of my daughter. And I'm humbled as well, because I don't know if I was put in that situation whether I could be as resolute and as giving in those circumstances. And this is why, one of the primary reasons why I'm walking, is to honour that sacrifice she made and the warmth that she gave in what were tragic circumstances.
You're listening to Ramblings on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. I'm walking today in Hampshire along the banks of the River Itchen in the company of Andrew Simpkins, who has just completed an epic walk of the border, really, the coastline and the borders of England, in memory of his daughter Alice. What a wonderful way to give yourself time as well to process and try and, you know, as much as one can, try and cope with your loss.
Well, the interesting thing now is how I'm going to continue that. Because when I finished, and as I say, only finished 2 days ago, you know, there was that elation. But almost instantaneously, that there was that doubt about how can I continue this in some way? You know, and I have to have a project to continue this relationship I have with Alice. Just over two months ago, I was on Hadrian's Wall, and very close to Sycamore Gap, there's a road. The path takes a dip to a road and then climbs up again to Sycamore Gap. And my left knee suddenly locked on me, and I hobbled to the road and caught the delightfully numbered AD122 bus and went down to Hexham and went to A&E, and they x-rayed it, checked it over and gave me painkillers. But it's only got better in the last week and I'm fine, actually, and I will, you know, easily make the end. But I've had a pretty tough last 7 odd weeks, never quite knowing whether or not my knee was going to hold up. I think my knees are saying, look, we've been supporting you all these miles, give us a break. and so it sort of put me on edge whether or not I would actually, you know, be in the position to get here today.
Because the one thing that you would be constantly concerned about is twisting an ankle, yeah, twisting yeah. a knee, blisters, I suppose, as well. Can really set you off, you know, that's yeah. really painful to deal with.
I haven't over worried. I've got excellent boots, you know, and I'm very happy with those. I have had blisters occasionally. I have broken a couple of bones in a foot on the Isle of Wight, but you know, touch wood. I have staggered on.
There's a very large white cow on the left of us, with its backside up against the stump of a tree, just scratching itself and moaning almost in satisfaction. And the stream flowing on our right in the direction that we're walking. The sun has come out now and lighting the path ahead of us, which, because it's damp, is glistening white and stretching as far as we can see ahead. And the people that were so plentiful at the beginning have faded now as we get a little bit more remote from parking and from Winchester itself.
We've reached Compton Lock, and it was a lock, it's not now, because the river was made navigable in early 1700s for flat-bottom barges to get to Winchester. And that remained the case until the railways came, inevitably. And so they've taken the locks away and the water's flowing quite freely. But this is a wild swimming site, and you can see that there are steps down into the water. I don't think it's wild swimming, I think it's quite luxurious. In fact, yesterday when I did a recce, I met a lady just up here with a mug of coffee and a big bag on her shoulder. And I said, are you going swimming? And she said, you bet. And the previous times I've come in here, there have been families swimming in here. And it's on the website as a suitable place. Normally, the river isn't running so fast.
Well, you say normally, but I found out the derivation of itching.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not quite excited about this. So it's after the Celtic word issa, which means rapid running water.
Well, there you go. You can see it now.
So it always was rapid running.
Yeah.
But that is a lovely spot, and we can see it's quite deep, and it's so clear. You can see right down to the stones at the bottom, just that feeling of purity, which sadly so rare in our river network. Can I ask you about the planning for a walk of that length and complexity? How do you start the very beginning? You know.
Yeah, well, Southwest Coast Path is a given because there's a very good guidebook, and I've generally tried to walk a long ways because they're well marked and they're well established. But of course, I have to link those up, and the planning is, to a degree, at least 50% of the whole exercise. I love poring over a map and looking at train timetables and bus timetables and booking accommodation. And I have done this almost exclusively on my own. And I have used local buses everywhere. And I am waving a flag for the brilliance of our local bus services, particularly around the coasts, because they have got me to the most inaccessible places. And the only times I've made a mistake is when I've read the timetable wrong.
Did you have a set number of miles that you knew you could do every day?
That's a good question, but it depended on the bus stops. I walk almost exactly at 3 miles an hour wherever I am. Obviously, go down on the hills. And so I calculate it from the number of miles it's going to be. I used to be able to cover nearly 20 miles a day, but I'm, you know, down to about 15 or whatever now. So it all depends on the sort of logistics behind the walk.
This is a lovely section where the gardens of the houses on the other side of the river run right down to the river bank, and we've come across a colony of ducks. Must be, well, over 100 of them. Mallards. So the boys have got these very glamorous dark green heads, yellow beaks. Oh my word! In the garden opposite, there is quite a large roe deer just nibbling away at the hedgerow. It must come out of the woods. And it's decided that would be quite a lovely place to graze for the day. How cheeky. As you got towards the end, did you start thinking, oh, I don't want to stop, actually. How can I prolong this?
Absolutely, and I started doing shorter walks so that I had more days of actual walking. And no, it became quite difficult, and I was looking at the map and thinking, this is the last time that I'll be looking at one of these Ordnance Survey maps in this context. And I found that very difficult to accept.
Did your wife, Jane, how much was she involved in terms of supporting you or indeed joining you on any of it?
She's a very good walker, and we do go for lots of walks along canal towpaths and such like. But this has been my project. She helped me out on Offa's Dyke, for example, and she has come with me to pick me up and drop me off on various routes. But on the whole, as I say, I have been in someone else's company.
Are you glad you did it?
Wow. Yes, gosh. Yeah. I feel lucky that I've done it. I feel lucky that it came my way. And as I've said to you, I'm feeling slightly bereft that it's now behind me, so I have to move on to something else. And if it has kept that link to Alice, then it has been worthwhile every second, every blister, every broken toe.
And she will be with you on the next challenge, always. Do you know yet what that will be?
I have some ideas. It may be cycling, not walking. But walking will be part of it.
Can I ask you, what is your current state of mind? And what gives you hope?
I'm very much at peace with the world because I know that I live with Alice's legacy. You know, we can't change the past, so we are where we are. And Alice had a lovely girl, and her partner remarried and had another child, and so that legacy continues on. And, you know, I see Alice in our granddaughter, and I get, you know, satisfaction from that. So there was an end in one way, but there was a new beginning in another.
Well, we are at the end of our walk, but I know that you're going to leave us here, because I feel the one thing I feel about today is I've invaded your space, and I want to make sure you've got your walk that's your walk without having to talk about everything. So are you going to walk back?
Yes, I'm going to turn around now and walk back and contemplate, but with great thanks to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
Ramblings is presented by Claire Balding and produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
On BBC iPlayer.
Asia is home to the most extraordinary life. The largest owls. The world's smallest elephants. The richest seas on the planet. The biggest of all big cats. The world's rarest bear.
Asia with David Attenborough.
If you think you've seen the best the natural world has to offer, think again.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Now here's Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. Coming up today, a collaborative approach to sheep disease.
For example, we're here with 700 sheep. We could be finished here in 3.5 hours, where that could have taken a day and a half in the old system.
And the politics and the practicalities of inheritance tax.
If you analyse the amount of money they have invested in their business, this 1, 2 or 3 million, whatever they decide it's going to be, I mean, everyone is going to have to get involved with it. And certainly my accountant tells me that there will be tax to pay.
First, though, farmers in North Somerset say plans to create salt marshes to offset the environmental impact of a new power station would be disastrous for their homes and livelihoods. Energy giant EDF is building a nuclear power plant, Hinkley Point C, on the Bristol Channel. And to offset the number of fish that'll be killed when it's up and running, EDF is looking to create salt marshes along the River Severn. It needs more than 800 acres and is considering the compulsory purchase of agricultural land. BBC Points West reporter Ross Pollard has been to Kingston Seymour near Clevedon, which is being considered as a possible location.
Dan's been showing me around his dairy farm.
This is my parents' house. My house is behind, and further up the drive is my sister's house. We've also got all the farm infrastructure that we've put in place, the new milking parlour we put in last year.
His family have been here for decades and say news from EDF that their farm is being surveyed and could become a salt marsh is devastating.
So I've got two young children who are absolutely farming mad. And, you know, one day I would love to be able to offer this to them and for them to carry on as a fifth generation. But if EDF goes ahead and creates salt marsh out here, that's not going to be an option for them. You know, they want to flood 800 acres. We're not making land anymore. You know, we can't just go off and, you know, find somewhere else.
Down the road from Dan's farm is Dow Lace Farm Holidays. Only sheep are here today, but it's packed each summer with visitors. The Kirk family are worried about their future.
Yeah. It was shock. It's like, it feels a little bit like an ambush. because they were talking of compulsory surveys within 10 to 14 days of their first notice to us. Mm-hmm. And that feels like an attack.
It doesn't make sense to destroy one habitat to create another, and still the fish are going to be killed further down at Hinkley Point C.
Kind of always hoped that I'd take over the farm at some point and make a living myself out of it. And like Dad said, it's almost an attack on my future.
Kingston Seymour is one of several sites being looked at, including Arlingham in Gloucestershire, where people packed a local meeting recently to find out more information. EDF says it's still very early days and no decisions have been made.
My name's Andrew Cockcroft and I'm Head of Stakeholder Relations for the Hinkley Point C project. Those people, we really do understand those concerns. Over the weeks and months ahead, we'll be working with them to really get an understanding of the position of their business and what we can do to work together with them in terms of compensation, and also how we can adjust our plans accordingly to what their feedback is.
Until information is gathered from these sites, no one knows if their land could become salt marsh. People here say it's the unknown that's the hardest toll to bear.
That report from Ross Pollard. With the leaves on the trees turning, this is an important time of year for sheep farmers up and down the country. The autumn sheep sales are underway. Now, sheep are something we've been focusing on all week on our sister programme, Farming Today, which goes out here on BBC Radio 4 every weekday morning at 5:45, or you can catch it whenever you like on BBC Sounds. Well, sheep prices in general are up this year, but many upland farmers are still reliant on basic payments from government to make a profit. These are being phased out in England and at a faster rate since last week's budget, and they're being replaced with the Environmental Land Management Schemes, ELMS, which pay farmers for things like improving soil or planting hedges. Helen Milliken's been at a Swaledale sale in Cumbria, where she found hill farmers Richard and Jess Pedley waiting for their ram's big moment in the ring.
There's a real buzz sale time approaches at Kirby Stephen Auction Mart. Day three of the Swaledale Ram Sale.
It's one we look forward to every year.
Big day for you, Richard Pedley. You're selling today.
Selling today. Trade was reasonable yesterday. We've seen an increase in price for the majority breeding lambs this back end. Finished lambs are dearer. Sow lambs are slightly dearer than last year. Yeah, our costs keep going up. So while things read like it's good price-wise, we're not making any more money. And long-term, it's quite worrying. Well, short-term, it's quite worrying. Upland farms will really struggle without that basic payment scheme money. At the moment, there's nothing really to replace that with.
If the hill farms go, people will miss the sheep. I mean, the Swaledale and the upland breeds, they're vital in the stratification of the whole sheep breed. The Swaledale, you need to breed the North of England mule, which are tremendous mothers for the fat lambs.
That is one of the biggest issues that we're struggling to get across to DEFRA officials and those that are behind a lot of these new schemes. Back in September, we've had the North of England Mulegum lamb sales all across the North of England. And without the Swaledale sheep, which are bred on the hills, you'll not get a mule lamb.
Meeting up to compare notes are past chairman of the Swaledale Sheep Breeders Association, Will Cockburn, and current incumbent, Greg Dalton.
At the moment, the sheep market is probably as good as it's ever been, but sadly, you ask most farmers how they feel actually about the future and financially how they feel, and they're jolly hard up, to be quite honest. It's a bit of a sad reflection that we're in that stage at the moment. We look after the countryside. We're almost custodians of the countryside, of course.
But as custodians of the countryside, you therefore have a responsibility to farm fewer sheep and farm possibly in a different way.
I'll turn that round, and the farmer's first responsibility is to himself and his family to make a living. And if the government wants other things involved, like environmental stewardship and the rest of it, there needs to be incentives and schemes put in place to reward that. Most hill farmers have been in environmental schemes for years, yet the basic payment scheme was still the bigger payment, so it's just leading to a decline in incomes, which is now starting to lead to some quite dramatic change.
I mean, I have a young family. Do I want to encourage them into farming at this present moment in time? I'm not sure. That is the worry. If we want farm to continue, we need younger generation, and if the businesses aren't good enough and the money doesn't stack up, we'll go and do something else.
So when we read headlines in the local papers focusing on the buoyancy of the market, what really lies underneath is something much more complicated.
It's undoubtedly true that there is a buoyancy in the market, but there's a buoyancy in the market because the UK sheep flocks contracted, European sheep flocks contracted, even New Zealand and Australia's contracted a little bit. But the buoyancy in the marketplace isn't making up for the loss of income coming from other schemes that we used to have. So what we need is some common sense and some schemes that keeps farming families and rural communities together, rewards farmers for being farmers, and rewards farmers for protecting and enhancing the environment.
Hill farmer Will Cockbane at the Kirby Stephen Ramsales in Cumbria. DEFRA told us, our focus will be on making sure funding is used to the best effect for food, farming and nature, and that our schemes work for farms who have been too often ignored, such as small, grassland, upland and tenanted farms. Now, one of the sheep industry's most enduring health and welfare challenges is scab. It's an itchy condition caused by mites. It's controlled either by injecting a dose of medicine or the traditional dipping of sheep. But increasing resistance to the injection method means more and more farmers are moving back to sheep dip. Organophosphate dip is toxic and can harm human health and pollute waterways. Anyone buying or using sheep dip now needs a certificate of competency. Because of that, professional mobile dipping contractors are becoming more common. Nancy Nicholson has been to see a mobile setup in action on the islands of Lewis and Harris in a project by the Morden Research Institute.
Hey! So we're watching some sheep being plunged right down into a bath so they get dipped twice.
Yeah, and you should see a difference in your sheep within a few days. Because they're not scratching everything, so they can carry on eating rather than concentrating on scratching and losing weight.
That bath is a giant tank on the back of a lorry filled with organophosphate dip. The action's taking place in Shawbost on the west side of Lewis, and the mobile dipper is a game changer for crofters who've gathered with their sheep from miles around.
I've taken 20 lambs up here today. And my sheep were on the moor, which we gathered the other day. It's great, this new machine. It's absolutely fantastic.
What would you normally do? Would you have to dip them yourself?
Yes, we'd have to drag them over to the dipper, and that's not an easy job to do. Hard on the muscles.
Seems to be an older generation that are taking to do with sheep. There's not a good uptake with the youngsters, so there's a lot of pressure, I suppose, put on the ones that are more fit to be able to be more hands-on and to be doing things. Plus, it's not nice working with the dip either, and it can be quite dangerous in some cases.
We're able to dip upwards of 15 sheep at a time, whereas with the old system of doing it manually, you've got one animal going through the swim-through dipper. For example, we're here with 700 sheep. We could be finished here in 3.5 hours, where that could have taken a day and a half in the old system.
Ali Williamson, you're one of the bigger producers on the island. How much of a problem is sheep scab here?
Last year it was more of an issue, and we've been able to, through the project last year, make a big dent in the amount of sheep scab that's visible. We're hoping to dip upwards of 30,000 sheep. It means that the island has the possibility of getting close to eradicating sheep scab. We are very fortunate throughout Lewis and Harris that we've had a huge buy-in, and this year, being at our second year, we've actually, the ones who didn't do it last year are actually bought into it this year. I'm fortunate enough to go around the island and see quite a lot of sheep throughout the island. I can see a massive difference that it actually has made to the overall health of the local flock.
How will you be able to keep the problem out when some people overwinter sheep on the mainland, or you have to buy taps in?
That's always going to be an ongoing issue with us because we have 3 ports of entry to the island. But our main goal at the moment is education. We're trying to educate people with buying in tups about their isolation and any diseases that they may have, so that we can, as a whole and as a community, bring the overall health of the island's flock up to a level.
Crofting is traditionally a communal activity. Is this a really good way of reviving that spirit?
Absolutely no doubt about that. There's many men and women at this fank just now who wouldn't have seen so many animals at the fank and so many people together. And that's been one of the major things that's come out of this that we never expected. The community collaborative effort. Folk are all coming with their cups of tea and their flasks, and that stuff hadn't happened for years. And it's been a real community benefit and a real community buzz about it.
Nancy Nicholson reporting there from the west coast of Lewis. Over a week on from the budget, feelings are still running high over some of the changes farmers are facing. There's the increased rate of withdrawal of basic payments to English farmers, the carbon tax on imported fertiliser, and then there's the main subject of debate, the introduction of inheritance tax of 20% for farmers and landowners with £1 million worth or more of assets. The Ulster Farmers Union has held what it called crisis talks with food businesses this week, saying that including farms in inheritance tax and not ring-fencing the agriculture budget will be a massive blow to Northern Irish farmers. And in Wales, farmers meeting for NFU Cymru's AGM in Ceredigion told the BBC's Stephen Messenger what they thought of the tax.
So my name's Leisha Tudor, so originally from a farm near Aberystwyth, but I moved up to farm with my partner near Tywyn now in Mid Wales.
What do you make of this news about the inheritance tax? How worrying is it for yourself?
So it's quite worrying, being from a family farm and then moved up to my partner's family farm now as well. The main messages coming out of the conference today has been around, you know, the long-term sustainability, food security of family farms. And unfortunately, this inheritance tax goes completely against the messaging that we're hearing today. So, yeah, it is a very big worry.
My name is Bernard Llewellyn, and I farm at a place called Carrickenyn Castle near Llandeilo in Carmarthenshire. I think it's probably concerning to the huge majority of Welsh farmers, particularly livestock farmers, because if you analyse the amount of money they have invested in their business, this 1, 2 or 3 million, whatever they decide it's going to be in the end, I mean, everyone is going to have to get involved with it. And certainly my accountant tells me that there will be tax to pay as far as the land has been handed on is concerned. And that really, I don't mind if it was me who had to pay it, that's my choice, but certainly to hand really debt to the next generation, I think, is very, very short-sighted.
You said it would mean the end of the family farm, full stop.
Well, I think that is almost inevitable in many cases, because with what you've got to pay and what you've got to pay out, I mean, no one in their right mind are really going to take that sort of debt on.
Well, in Parliament, the new leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, called it the cruel family farms tax. And some are concerned that it will mean that when a farmer dies, their family will have to sell some or all of their land to pay it. The National Farmers Union met with DEFRA and the Treasury earlier this week. And after that meeting, President Tom Bradshaw said the union and government disagree on how many farms will have to pay.
The Treasury is saying only 27% of farms will be within scope of these changes. DEFRA's own figures suggest that two-thirds of farms will be caught, will be within scope. I mean, there's certainly no resolution today. We've made very passionately our perspective clear that this tax change is completely unfair. And now there are many, many family farms right the way across the United Kingdom that are worried for their future. Something has to change. You know, I have never seen the weight of support, the strength of feeling and anger that there is in this industry today. Many of them want to be militant. Now, we are not encouraging that in any way, shape or form. But government need to understand that there is a real, real strength of feeling behind what this change means for the future of family farming in this country.
NFU President Tom Bradshaw there. The DEFRA Secretary, Steve Reid, told Anna Hill the changes will raise more money for public services and stop people buying land just to avoid inheritance tax.
I don't think it helps farmers or anybody else if wealthy individuals are able to buy up land as a means of avoiding their inheritance tax liability. But it isn't just that. You know, I'm going to be absolutely honest with you here. We think that, you know, the wealthiest landowners and the wealthiest people in the sector can afford to contribute more at that point. But I said we're going to be fair and proportionate in doing this. And under the changes that have been proposed, 73% of claimants will still pay nothing at all in inheritance tax. And those farms will pass from one generation to the next, as they always have.
You say you're being fair and proportionate, but the words being used by farmers about this change are betrayal, vindictiveness, the death of the family farm, bringing the industry to its knees.
Well, I've heard that language, and first of all, it's important to say this. I understand the anxiety that people in the farming community, that farmers feel about any changes that are being proposed. Changes after, you know, several decades of a system operating in one way are always going to be unnerving. However, that doesn't mean that people should believe every single headline that they read. Many, many of them have just been simply misleading. Based on the claims for the last year we have information available, 73% of claimants would pay nothing.
The problem is there's a dispute about how many farms will be impacted by this change. The Treasury says the majority of farms won't be affected, and that's what you're saying. Strutt and Parker told this programme the majority of farms will be affected. Who is right?
Well, I don't recognise these alternative figures that are being bandied around, I'm afraid. The figures that I'm relying on and the figures that the Treasury are relying on are hard data. They're from HMRC, and it's based on the number of claims in the last year for which data is available. That should say to people, it gives people some reassurance that the vast majority of farms will be able to pass on to the next generation without incurring a liability. Now, for instance, if you've got a couple who own a farm and they want to pass it on to their son or their daughter, one partner predeceases the other, each of them has a £1 million APR threshold that they can pass on. You add those two together, that's 2 million, plus the 1 million that a couple can pass on to their children in any case, that's 3 million. So up to £3 million, many people will not have to pay anything in APR.
Farmers are really angry about this. The NFU says many farmers, and I quote, want to be militant because they're so angry, and they say something has to change. Are you going to consider making any changes at all?
Well, this is a fair and proportionate way of going about plugging the hole in the finances that has caused such disruption to our economy over the last decade and beyond that.
You've also announced a faster phasing out of direct payments to farmers in England. That's pretty late notice, isn't it, for businesses which need to make plans well in advance. Is that fair?
Well, I make no bones about the fact that there were some very difficult decisions taken in this budget. But, you know, people know that BPS was going to be phased out anyway. It's not really offering value for money. And what I wanted to do, frankly, was protect the ELMS schemes, that part of the farming budget. And as a result of that, we're looking at £5 billion being spent in the farming budget over the next 2 years. That's the biggest budget ever for food production and nature in our country's history. Now, farmers were telling me before the budget was announced that they wanted this government to protect that kind of funding for farming and for agriculture, and we've done it.
Yeah, but they didn't ask you to do it by reducing their payments much faster than they expected.
No, I'm sure, you know, everybody would like, you know, as much money as they can get out of every single scheme. But in the real world, there's £22 billion black hole in the public finances. And protecting the agriculture budget, protecting the ELMS schemes, meant taking difficult decisions elsewhere. So although I'm sorry that we've had to do it, I think it was the right thing to do, because I want to support those farmers who are in the ELM schemes like SFI, who are moving to different, more nature-positive models of farming. I think that's not just environmentally more sustainable. I think in the long term, it's more financially sustainable for farms as well. And I wanted to send the signal that we're supporting farms in that way.
And finally, we've heard on the programme from farmers still waiting for money from the Farming Recovery Fund. Now, that's the cash promised to farmers who were affected by last winter's floods. You've increased the fund to 60 million, but when will the money get to farmers who are still sitting on soggy ground, I have to say?
Absolutely right. And I'm glad we're ending here on a positive, because another thing farmers were saying to me very clearly is that they want that flood recovery money through the Farm Recovery Fund. We've increased it to 60 million. Letters have gone out from the RPA as it happens today. So I hope some of your listeners will be receiving those letters over the next day or two, and we can make sure that money gets out the door to help them recover from the huge damage caused by the floods last year.
The Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, Steve Reid. There is still some confusion about how much inheritance tax farmers will have to pay. The rules say tax is due on assets over £1 million, with other allowances that's £2 million. But in that interview, Steve Reid mentioned a figure of £3 million. The government, though, points out that if people pass on their farm more than 7 years before their death, known as gifting, then no inheritance tax would be due. Well, to try to get to the bottom of the practicality realities. Kaz Graham's been speaking to Rob Hitch. He advises farmers across the north on tax affairs for the accountants Dodd & Co, based in Carlisle.
Each individual would have up to £1 million of agricultural property relief or business property relief available. But alongside that, they'll also have a normal nil rate band that everybody gets, which is £325,000, and potentially a residential nil rate band of £175,000. In most farm cases, that would cover the farmhouse or part of it. So each individual, in theory, gets £1.5 million. And I suppose for a married couple or civil partners, that would equate to £3 million between them.
What about the detail then? Does a couple on a farm, because you're talking about if there are two people on the farm, does that ownership have to be a legal business partnership, or do they just have to be married or in a civil partnership?
At the moment, the residential nil rate band and the basic nil rate band are transferable between spouses, whereas agricultural property relief or business property relief appears to be not transferable. So in a husband and wife situation, if all the property is in wife's name, for argument's sake, and husband owns none of it, then he won't get to use his £1 million nil rate band because he doesn't have any assets that qualify.
And what if the farm is already owned by a kind of family partnership? Presumably tax is only liable on the percentage of the farm held by the person who has sadly died.
Absolutely. And that also takes into account what's the net value, you know, how much debt is against it, what liabilities are in that business as well. If the farm's worth £2 million, but there's £1 million of debt on it, then potentially there's only £1 million of equity that's chargeable.
Yeah. What are the measures that farmers can take if they want to ensure that they'll be able to hand their farm on to the next generation?
Well, I think a lot of the businesses I talk to probably already make gifts during lifetime, and I think that will become the norm. So I think there are things that can be done for people that have got time to make those gifts and survive the requisite 7 years.
What do you advise farmers who are worried? I know you've got a bit of a traffic light system, haven't you?
I've got a green light for anyone that's basically 60 or younger. For the vast majority of people, you can plan at that point in time. The people in the amber category, between 60 and 70 or 75, you know, they should live 7 years. They can make gifts. They can do things. I think the category in the red light section are probably those over 70 or 75 who, you know, we've had the same rules for 40 years and then suddenly they changed overnight. Those sort of people don't have the opportunity to give it and be secure that they will live 7 years and drop it out of their estate. And that seems blatantly unfair. You know, if you're in that category, you'd be lobbying government for some sort of transitional relief.
Farming tax advisor Rob Hitch. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Heather Simons. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Now, just before we join the Today programme, Elizabeth Rizzini is here with a look at the weather.
Thank you very much and good morning. Well, however the weather was for you yesterday across the UK, we're likely to see something similar again today. So, yes, some brighter skies, some sunshine, most likely across northern and eastern areas of Scotland and through northwest England, we could see some pockets of brightness. But for many of us, it looks very much as if the gloom, the low cloud is just set to continue again for one more day. Then we'll start to see some changes from the north and the west tomorrow with some showers and eventually some drier air. So less moisture in it. There will be more in the way of brightness and sunshine, not just tomorrow, but also into the start of next week. For today, though, there's some mist and some hill fog around, some more stubborn fog across northwest Scotland that will be slow to lift and clear through the morning. Could be a bit of patchy drizzle again from the thickness of all of that cloud across much of England, Wales and Northern Ireland. But generally speaking, largely dry, just rather grey and dreary. It'll brighten up across northern eastern areas of Scotland in particular, and we'll also see some pockets of brightness across northwest England, probably northwest Wales as well. Feeling a little chillier for most of us than it was yesterday. Top temperatures this afternoon of 8 to 10 degrees Celsius, but maybe 11 to 14 for Northern Ireland, Wales and parts of western Scotland. Overnight tonight it is set to stay rather cloudy. There will be some clear spells, especially out towards the east, so here we could see perhaps a touch of ground frost, especially across northeastern Scotland. Scotland. Elsewhere, lots of thick cloud and some more coastal and hill fog forming. Tomorrow, Remembrance Sunday, there is a weather front bringing some patchy rain into Northern Ireland or Western Scotland that will gradually track its way further southwards and eastwards through the day. A bit more in the way of brightness and temperatures will start to pick up a little. That's the forecast.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Now let's take a look ahead to Monday when Radio 4 has a new book at bedtime.
The Prime Minister was standing at the window.
Precipice by Robert Harris.
Thinking of Venetia.
An obsessive affair fuels dangerous behaviour.
He showed her a telegram from the ambassador in Berlin and afterwards tore it up and scattered the pieces out of the car window.
A threat to national security with the country on the brink of war.
The notion that anyone might discover he was sending her secret telegrams was unthinkable. He blew her the ghost of a kiss.
Precipice by Robert Harris on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday to Friday night at 10:45.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 9th of November. Good to have you with us. Good to be with you. This is Today with Simon Jack and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning, the veteran Democrat politician Nancy Pelosi says Joe Biden must share the blame for the party's crushing election loss as Donald Trump's Republicans edge towards full control of the US Congress. And a DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading, raising concerns about what has happened to customers' personal data. We'll talk to our technology editor.
Also in today's programme, the Wall Street investor and longtime watcher of the world's richest man, Ross Gerber, on the new so-called Trump-Elon Musk administration. Can the double act work?
It is an odd couple at best and certainly crazy at worst. So, you know, welcome to the new world.
We'll be getting more into that throughout the programme, not least with relation to Ukraine. Should the NHS produce its own branded formula milk to help those mothers struggling with or unable to breastfeed or not wanting to? That's a new suggestion in the offing. We'll get into that. And have you been feeling a bit dreary because of the clouds in recent days? You aren't the only one. Anti-cyclonic gloom. We shall explain all and go to Scotland, no less, for a reminder to the rest of us what the sun can actually look like.
Good morning from Mike Williams with the Saturday Sport. Defeat for Ireland in their opening Rugby Autumn Nations match last night. They were beaten by New Zealand in Dublin. Meanwhile, in Barbados, England's cricketers start their five-match T20 series later today with the West Indies.
All that and more. The BBC News, though, first of all, is read by Alan Smith.
The former Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has partly blamed President Biden for the Democrats' bruising election defeat, suggesting they would have fared better if he'd pulled out of the race sooner. Ms. Pelosi is understood to have played a key role in persuading Mr. Biden to end his re-election bid, but she said her party could have used more time to choose his replacement. Democrats are involved in a public post-mortem after losing hold of the White House and potentially control of both chambers of Congress, as Samira Hussain reports from Washington.
Now that the election is over, the recriminations have begun in the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House, and one of the most influential people in the party, largely blamed U.S. President Joe Biden for the Democrats' crushing defeat. In an interview with the New York Times, Ms. Pelosi said, had he stepped aside earlier, there could have been other candidates in the race. As Democrats lick their wounds, Republicans are on the verge of a clean sweep, already winning the presidency and control of the Senate. They are just 6 votes shy of winning the House of Representatives. That kind of political power gives President-elect Donald Trump free rein to enact the policies he sees fit. One person who might shape his agenda is the billionaire Elon Musk, who joined Mr. Trump in a phone call with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Iran has rejected American claims that it recruited a man to assassinate Donald Trump. The U.S. Justice Department has charged Farah Shakeri, who it says told police he was instructed to kill the president-elect last month. He's now believed to be in Iran. Senior U.S. officials have said Washington no longer accepts the presence of Hamas representatives in Qatar, the American ally which has played a major role in the fruitless talks to try to broker a ceasefire in Gaza and free Israeli hostages. The anonymous officials said Hamas's leaders should not be welcome in the capitals of any U.S. partner after they rejected the latest proposal. Joe Inwood sent this report from Jerusalem.
Qatar has played a key diplomatic role in trying to bring an end to this conflict. As well as taking part in talks, it's hosted the political office of Hamas, allowing the group to operate with relative freedom. But the message from Washington is that that agreement must come to an end. Speaking anonymously, a senior US official said Hamas's rejection of another ceasefire and hostage deal was the final straw. They added the message had been delivered to Hamas 10 days ago. Qatar has yet to respond to the reports. Three Hamas officials have said they are untrue. But this comes from a US administration soon to be out of power. President Biden may want to secure a deal in his final months. Everyone else around the table knows he will soon be replaced. And it is Donald Trump they will have to deal with.
Police in Pakistan say at least 24 people have been killed in a powerful explosion at a railway station in the southwestern city of Quetta. No group has claimed responsibility for the blast. A UK-based DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading without telling its customers, raising concerns about what's happened to their data. Atlas Biomeds used saliva samples to profile people's unique genetic makeup, but its website no longer works, and the firm's last update on social media was over a year ago. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Atlas Biomeds' accounts are long overdue, according to Companies House, but the firm is still listed as being active. It has two public addresses in London, which the BBC visited. One had never heard of the DNA testing company, and the second was home to the firm which registered it, but not Atlas Biomed itself. Two of its remaining officers share an address in Moscow, according to their filings, along with a third man, a major shareholder who is also a Russian billionaire. The data watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, confirmed that it had received a complaint about the company. Customers the BBC spoke to said they were worried about their data and annoyed they'd paid for a service they could no longer access. Privacy experts urge caution around sharing DNA samples for profiling, as it's such deeply personal and valuable information. And sharing it also impacts close relatives who are likely to have similar traits.
The Metropolitan Police has denied claims that farmers have been banned from protesting in London about government plans to remove an exemption from inheritance tax for some. Farmers and their supporters, including the TV presenter Jeremy Clarkson, claimed they'd been prevented from holding a rally on November the 19th because of two-tier policing, which favoured pro-Palestine protests. Here's our political correspondent Tom Simons.
The row over plans for farmers to protest in London appears to have been triggered by an event being organised by the National Farmers Union. This isn't a protest. It's a lobby of MPs by 1,800 members at a conference centre. Numbers are limited, so some, including reportedly the TV presenter and farmer Jeremy Clarkson, have been turned away. Amid some confusion, it was suggested the Metropolitan Police had banned a protest. The Met has denied this. It can only prevent demonstrations if there is a serious risk of disorder, and Scotland Yard said it would work with anyone wanting to protest peacefully. So now a separate rally is being organised on the same day to demonstrate farmers' anger at government plans to remove an exemption from inheritance tax for more valuable farmland and assets.
More than 30 firefighters, police officers and other public servants who died in the line of duty have become the first to posthumously receive a new award in recognition of their sacrifice. The Elizabeth Emblem, named after the late Queen, will be given to the recipients' families. More details from Tim Mufford.
For years, there have been calls from campaigners for a formal posthumous award to honour public servants who die in the line of duty. The Elizabeth Emblem was first announced in March. It will be the civilian equivalent of the Elizabeth Cross, which honours members of the armed forces who die in action. The first 38 recipients include PC Nathaniel Edgar, who was murdered in 1948 whilst investigating a spate of burglaries in North London, and PC Andrew Harper, who was killed in Berkshire in 2019 after he was dragged along by a car having responded to reports of a theft from a property. Bryn Hughes has led the campaign for the honour. His daughter, PC Nicola Hughes, was murdered in 2012 alongside PC Fiona Bone in Greater Manchester.
Not only just Nicola and Fiona, but other police officers. They go to work every day and they're serving the Crown and they're wearing a crown on their uniform, and quite rightly so. They should be recognised by the Crown, by the state, and I think that's important that they are recognised.
The design of the emblem includes a rosemary wreath, a traditional sign of remembrance, and is inscribed with the words, "For a life given in service."
Space historians are trying to establish why the UK's oldest satellite appears to be in the wrong part of the sky. The military spacecraft known as Skynet 1A was launched in 1969, but the records detailing when and why it got moved have been lost. Jonathan Amos has the story.
Shortly after man landed on the moon, British forces entered the space age by getting their first telecommunications satellite. Sighted high above East Africa, Skynet 1A allowed London to talk securely with personnel as far away as Singapore. For several years it worked well, but when it died, the satellite spawned a mystery. Had it failed in place, it would now be drifting over the Indian Ocean, but it's actually sitting over Central America. Official records have been lost, but historians think the United States Air Force might have commanded some late manoeuvres. If that's true, they did the UK few favours, because they left Skynet 1A in a part of the sky where it risks running into today's operational satellites. And 50 years on, Britain is still responsible for the abandoned spacecraft.
That report was from Jonathan Amos.
Thanks very much, Alan. It's 9 minutes past seven. Let's take our first look through the morning papers and the bumper weekend crop. If you look at the front page of The Guardian, something will come on to you. Ukraine fears relations with the UK has worsened or have worsened since the Labour government took power in July. That's what officials in Kyiv have told the paper, expressing frustration over what it says are Britain's failure to supply extra long-range missiles. We'll come to that, and not least how Donald Trump is expected to respond to the war in Ukraine. On the front page of the Mail, Britain's first death from someone who has been taking a weight loss jab. She's an NHS nurse. It's the first time someone in this country, their death has been directly linked to one of those jabs. Susan McGowan, 58 years of age, suffered multiple organ failure, septic shock and pancreatitis, after taking two low-dose injections with the brand name Mounjaro. And she bought it from an online pharmacy, but it has been recently approved for use on the NHS. So there's calls for the tightening of regulation around that, especially as we hear that the new Labour government want to use those jabs to help with the obesity crisis. And Simon, one for us. On the front of the Times Saturday magazine, Wakey Wakey, Why Everything You Thought You Knew About Sleep Is Wrong. And some tips, including Gwyneth Paltrow puts mouth tape on, apparently, when she starts preparing for bed.
But tape over her mouth.
Tape over her mouth. I cannot tell you any more at this point.
Maybe it's to make her breathe through her nose. I don't know.
You're probably right.
Okay.
I'm not doing it, though.
Okay. The two slightly different takes on what the big events of the last week and a half will mean for our personal finances, that is the Trump election and the Rachel Reeves budget. The I says UK mortgage rates set to stay higher in 2025 thanks to Reeves and Trump. They say 3.1 million households, UK households, are now likely to be hit by higher mortgage costs than expected, with a double whammy effect of Rachel Reeves' budget, which the OBR, the budget watchdog, said would push inflation slightly higher than it would have been for longer, slowing down interest rate cuts, and the US presidential election, which the FT says risks overheating. The US economy risks overheating. You saw the S&P 500, their stock market went shooting up this week. So did the shares in Tesla. So did Bitcoin, thinking this the deregulation and the animal spirits of a Trump presidency will supercharge, if you like, the US economy, and that also could lead to inflation. They say Tesla chief Elon Musk, one of Trump's firmest backers, joined the president-elect on Wednesday in a call with the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky, something we are going to get into in some detail a little bit later in the programme.
We are, and we'll be speaking to the former Defence Secretary Ben Wallace about that, what's been called an unconventional move. But at 12 minutes past seven, let's get with the detail that we do have about that. As America and the world prepares for President Trump, the sequel, how he will deal with the war in Ukraine is one of the top issues in his foreign policy in-tray. And during his first call with Ukrainian President Mr. Zelensky, as we've just been hearing, he was joined, Mr. Trump, by one of his most famous and certainly his richest supporters, Elon Musk. Nada Torfik, our North America correspondent, told me what we know about this call.
Well, we know that Donald Trump was speaking, of course, with President Zelensky on Wednesday. It was about a 25-minute call or so. President Zelensky emerged from it feeling quite confident in the discussion, but also that Elon Musk was on it. Now, there wasn't any specifics of policy discussed, but it was quite interesting to see that Musk was on that call, given there was a lot of questions about what kind of influence he would have on the administration. I mean, Elon Musk was in a family photo after Donald Trump's election win. We know that Elon Musk has expressed support for Ukraine through his Starlink satellite network, which has been critical to Ukraine during wartime communications. But it was certainly interesting because Elon Musk has also been somebody who has kind of proposed his own peace plan for Ukraine on X, which really prompted a response from President Zelensky back in 2022, saying that he shouldn't be making suggestions that would lead to essentially looking like Ukraine should cede to Russia any territory. The kind of so-called peace plan proposal talked about redoing elections in annexed regions under UN supervision, also making Crimea formally a part of Russia. This has put, I'm sure, President Zelensky in a situation where he really has to kind of accept that Elon Musk has this new influence in the administration and questioning what that will mean for him.
And just turning our attention to the Democrats, where the post-mortem has begun with Nancy Pelosi starting to try and get a sense of what went wrong from their side and blame being apportioned in Joe Biden's direction, I should say. What's the latest on that?
Nancy Pelosi, the former U.S. Speaker of the House, she's a key Democrat, obviously. She's also one who was widely reported to have pushed President Biden out to let Kamala Harris win. And so many were looking to see when there would be soul searching what Nancy Pelosi would have to say. And she told the New York Times that if President Biden had got out sooner, then there may have been time for an open primary for candidates in the party to actually compete for a chance to be the nominee. Essentially, what Nancy Pelosi said was it just happened too late. He left the race too late. At that point, the only option was to just have the Vice President Kamala Harris step in. And that if she had had an open primary, that Kamala Harris may have done better. And it may have put her in a stronger position going into the election. It is just one more person laying the blame here on President Biden for the Democrats' loss.
Nada, thank you very much.
Nada Torfik there, 16 minutes past seven. Senior officials have said the presence of Hamas is no longer welcome at the peace talks in Qatar, attempting to bring an end to the war in Gaza. Joe Inwood is our correspondent. Joe, this seems a peculiar development if you're trying to negotiate an end to the war.
I should say, Simon, it's not the peace talks they're not welcome at. It's their political office is no longer welcome in Qatar, according to US officials. Now, since 2012, and reportedly at the request of the then Obama administration, Hamas set up a political office in Qatar, in this influential but small Middle Eastern state, a key ally of Washington and of other Western nations. And since then, they've had their political operations based out of there, and it's allowed indirect talks to take place. Now, what we're hearing reported from anonymous US officials, but these seem to be very credible reports, is that 10 days ago they told the Qataris that they were no longer happy with Hamas having a presence in Doha, and that they needed to find somewhere else. Now, reportedly, Hamas was told this, and so the Qataris, so we understand, have passed on the message. Now, we should say that Hamas have denied this, and Qatar have not yet commented. But it does seem like the American administration of Joe Biden is trying to put pressure on Hamas on these negotiations in the final days of its administration.
That is the question, isn't it? What, you've got a lame duck president, and what pressure can he exert in the last days of his administration?
Yeah, that is a really, really important question. And I think many will be seeing how it depends how the Qataris respond to this. It's fair to say that the ability of the American administration to put pressure on Israel has decreased significantly because they've got essentially their preferred candidate taking over in just a couple of months' time. What they're going to be hoping is that if the Qataris say to Hamas, look, unless you make a deal, you're going to have to leave, that puts pressure on them to do some sort of negotiated settlement. Now, Why would Hamas fear having to leave? And it's because the question is, where else would they go? We saw back in July that Israel was happy to assassinate their key political leader, that's Ismail Haniyeh. And then in October, they killed Yahya Sinwar, who was in Gaza. And so Hamas know that they are at risk of political assassinations. It's interesting, actually, they've changed their leadership model in the aftermath of those two killings. According to the European Council on Foreign Relations, they've now got a collective leadership model with five people running it in order to reduce the risk. Now, that shows that they know that this is a risk. And if they're forced to go somewhere else, which could be Turkey, could be Iran, or could potentially be Lebanon, they'll know that they are going to be potentially at more risk of being assassinated by Israel. And I think the Americans are hoping that that will force them to make some sort of hostage and peace deal.
And just wonder what the incoming presence of Donald Trump is doing to this, because Donald Trump is on record saying, I want Israel to win, but I want them to win fast. How is this going to change the complexion of this? And is there any merit for Hamas in trying to get some kind of deal done before that happens?
Yeah, that is, of course, with Donald Trump, it's always worth putting the caveat in that we really don't know. But in his speech declaring victory, he did say he wanted to end wars. And it's been reported here in Jerusalem that he said to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, that he wants some sort of deal agreed by the time he takes over power in January, on January the 20th. So it could be that all sides think that they want to get some sort of deal done quickly. But the thing is that the Israelis know that when Donald Trump takes over, any deal is more likely to be favourable to them. Mm. And maybe that is the reason that Hamas, who also know that, might try and come to the table. But this, it's really very difficult to know at this point.
OK, Joe, thanks a lot. Joe Inwood there, our correspondent.
At 20 past seven, let's turn our attention to the ongoing COVID inquiry this week, because the most senior doctor in NHS England has told it that he had concerns about some public health messaging during the pandemic. Sir Stephen Powis said patients may have been scared off getting the care that they really needed at that time. As always, our health reporter Jim Reid has been watching all of the evidence.
I listened tonight to everybody clapping for all the NHS workers, and you have no idea how much we appreciated it. But what we really, really would appreciate is if you would stay at home this weekend.
It was the most memorable slogan of the pandemic.
Stay at home, protect the NHS and save lives.
But this inquiry has heard repeated concerns that public health campaign may have been simply too effective.
I swear by Almighty God.
This week, the most senior doctor in the NHS had his say.
Stephen Hugh Powis.
Sir Stephen, a trained kidney specialist, is NHS England's medical director.
What lessons do you think can be learned about balancing that sort of public health messaging and ensuring continued access to healthcare for individuals who need it?
Well, the Protect the NHS message, which was a Cabinet Office developed communication strategy, I think was the best intent. But of course, unfortunately, some people might have interpreted that as stay away from the NHS, which was absolutely not what we wanted. I raised it in one of the Downing Street press conferences. I think it was the 4th of April or thereabouts. I stood up and actually I remember getting an email saying my husband had been sitting at home for a number of days, chest pain I think it was, and wouldn't go to hospital, and they heard you on the television and he went and they saved his life. So I know it had an impact. I won't get emotional here, but that was the, that was the, you know, we were worried.
The impact on NHS staff of all grades has been another running theme of this inquiry.
I swear by Almighty God.
Patricia Temple is a senior nurse, originally from South Africa.
Shall be the truth.
She was asked about strict rules brought in to try to reduce COVID infections in hospital.
What was the impact of having to impose visiting restrictions on patients and their families?
That was really sad. I found it really, really sad. I remember well one patient that we heard talking to his mum on the phone, a learning disabled man who couldn't understand why she couldn't come and see him, and he was dying. And you could hear him speaking on the phone to his mum and asking her to come. And it was very, very difficult to see them suffering without their loved ones there, to see them dying alone.
She is sure she caught the virus from that same patient. She spent 11 days in hospital herself with COVID and lives with long-term symptoms today.
I have a lot of nurses that I know who are trying very, very hard to stay in the workplace and are unable to do so. They are a valuable resource. They're not disposable. Having COVID and long COVID, you can't be clapped for 1 minute and declared disposable the next.
May I please call Professor Simon Ball?
Professor Simon Ball was the medical director at University Hospitals Birmingham NHS Trust.
I do solemnly, sincerely and truly.
At the height of the pandemic, the giant Queen Elizabeth Hospital in the city was looking after 142 patients in intensive care, double its normal capacity.
You've said in your statement, in short, maintaining the basis for admission to ICU, benefiting the patient population, nevertheless came at significant, often personal cost. Is that right?
I think that's true. And I think that there is no doubt that operating at the level of intensity, even for experienced ITU nurses, dealing with such an influx of very acutely sick patients who often spent many, many weeks on intensive care to recover, came at significant personal cost in terms of individuals' well-being. I think that's entirely true.
Next week, evidence from the person who now runs the entire NHS in England, plus more from someone we rarely hear from in public, the most senior civil servant in the Department of Health.
There you go. Jim Reid reporting on the COVID inquiry. You can hear more from him and what's been going on there in the form of the COVID inquiry podcast. Just search and subscribe on BBC Sounds for all of the episodes dating back to the start of the inquiry last year. But at 24 minutes past seven, I can tell you there's been just 18 minutes of sun in the last 12 days. That is the story for Hampshire. A picture of mist, fog and low cloud. Many of you, especially in the south of England, have suffered, we think is the right word, since the 28th of October. You may not have noticed, but if you have, just to say there was no sight of the sun at all there yesterday. You're not imagining this. There is a phenomenon going on called the anticyclonic gloom, where high pressure traps an area of moisture close to the surface of the earth. One part of the country that has fared much better, the eastern side of Scotland, which, sheltered by Scottish mountains, has seen clear skies and crisp wintry days. Well, Steve Gardner is a skipper from the coastal town of Anstruther who runs regular trips to the Isle of May in the Firth of Forth. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Apparently you're still in your shorts.
Not this morning, no. Slightly greyer this morning.
Okay. Well, I was told you were until very recently because you're faring better.
Yes, we've had a good stretch of weather just lately. The shorts have been on regularly.
It's not often that Scotland gets to be smug about the weather to southern England.
Well, probably not, though. I mean, it's been the double figures, temperature-wise, and clear skies at night. A lot of sunshine, blue skies at times. But, yeah, it's been really nice up here.
And tell us a little bit about your trips. What are you doing? Where do you take people? Who's travelling with you?
It's a national nature reserve. It's about 5 miles off the coast, known as the Isle of May. During the season, which is April through to the end of September, it's tourists, photographers, ornithologists. This time of year, it's maintenance crews and research people that were taken back and forward to the island.
And how's it been in terms of it's been before in November? Has it felt warm? Has it felt pleasant?
Oh, it's different. It's definitely different. I was out just the last day there, and generally this time of year we've got waterproofs on and to keep ourselves dry, but just a pair of trousers on, good sea conditions. That's what we always look at. But we've had a very, very light winds up here as well. So, yeah, it's been really good weather the last week or so.
Doing that sort of job, I mean, you know, I have an office-based job largely. Obviously, we go out and about and try and talk to people. But does it obviously affects you in a very practical way, but it also affects, you know, how you feel when the weather is better like that, your mood, because that's what, you know, even if you don't have seasonal affective disorder proper, you know, it does impact people, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it does make our job an awful lot easier when we've got good conditions. People and going out on the boats, if they get nice conditions, it's much easier for them. They enjoy the trips much more, which makes our life much more enjoyable.
Well, you've got bragger's rights, it seems. So, Stephen, we'll leave you with that. Stephen Gardner there. And, it's the first time I've heard of this. Have you heard of this before?
Anticyclonic gloom, no. But I know it when I see it.
I know it when I feel it.
I know it when I feel it. Yes, it's true. It has been the slate grey that kills you. I must say, it must be quite weird. I saw the weather forecast the other day and it was 70 degrees in Scotland in November. I think this is not right.
Well, we just wanted to reflect it before our usual weather.
Well, let us do our weather. And as if by magic, largely cloudy day for much of the UK, only brighter in some northwestern areas. So it's just proving the relevance of that piece there with our weather. And Mike, over to you with some sport.
Well, it was a dry night in Dublin, I can tell you that, last night, but it wasn't much good for Ireland's rugby union side, who for the first time in 3 years have lost a match at home.
New Zealand desperate for the ball. McKenzie hurls it in field. Satiti, great pickup. He gets it away to Amua. Amua to Jordan. Jordan in the corner. Vintage stuff from the All Blacks. And that might be the try that gets them a huge win in Dublin.
Yes, Ireland beaten 23-13 by New Zealand last night in their opening Autumn Nations Series match. Here is Captain Caelan Dorris.
It was intense out there. Felt like we were quite reactive throughout. Our discipline obviously wasn't where it needed to be, but, you know, they're a quality side. They put us under pressure right from the start throughout. Felt like we got momentum a little bit back early on in the second half, but they came back out and put us under pressure again. And, they were quality. We weren't good enough.
Well, the former England wing, Chris Ashton, joins us now live on the programme. Morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Going to talk about England against Australia in a moment, but first a word on that match in Dublin last night. How disappointed will the Irish be with that defeat? Because up until yesterday, they had a good recent record against the All Blacks.
Well, had a good recent record about everybody, really, against every team they played against. It became such a normal thing for us to be watching the attack, how good they attack, score tries, flow, how strong the defence was. We really didn't see any of that last night. I was really surprised, along with a lot of other people watching it, to see Ireland struggle to break down the New Zealand defence so much and allow New Zealand to score tries. So, yeah, very frustrating night for Andy Farrell's men.
So a word on England against Australia. You're heading off to Twickenham later. This England side showing signs of promise, aren't they? But we had Denny Kerr in this studio earlier on this week, and he was of the view, as of many England fans, I guess, that they just now need to turn these narrow defeats into victories.
Yeah, they do. There's actually a bit of pressure on this game because Australia have got some fantastic players. They've got a big new signing that's come across from Rugby League into Australia. Rugby have signed him over the summer. 21-year-old Joseph Soaili, who's going straight in to make his debut at 13. They've got some big forwards in the pack, some special props that could cause some damage. But Australia at the moment are sitting down in ninth in the world ranking. They've lost 5 out of 6 matches. It's just a potential banana skin for England there. They need to start well. People will be slightly frustrated from the game against New Zealand last weekend. We didn't see enough attacking rugby. Let's hope today that Steve Borthwick's men can score some tries.
Yeah, he's named an unchanged side, hasn't he, from that team that lost by 2 points to the All Blacks last week. 2 changes on the bench. Who does Borthwick need big performances from this afternoon?
The centres, really. Henry Slade and Ollie Lawrence are two lads that were really quiet last week. They've switched them around this weekend, so they've put Ollie Lawrence at 13 and Henry Slade at 12. Hopefully, within doing that, it gets Henry Slade a bit more ball playing out the back of players, and it can give Ollie Lawrence, who is our big carrier, a bit more space in the wider channels to do some damage.
All right, Chris, got to leave it there. Enjoy the match later. Many thanks for joining us. That is the former England wing, Chris Ashton. And you can hear England against Australia live from Twickenham on 5 Sports Extra this afternoon and BBC Sounds from 2:45. Just briefly elsewhere, 2 high-scoring games in the Women's Super League last night. Khadija Shaw scored a hat-trick as Manchester City extended their lead at the top with a 4-0 home win over Tottenham, whilst at the Emirates, Arsenal beat Brighton by 5-0. In tennis, Britain's Cameron Norrie will contest a 15th ATP Tour final later at the Marcel Open. He will climb into the world's top 50 next week, regardless of the result there. Whilst in cricket, Joss Butler returns to captain England later as they start their 5-match T20 series with the West Indies. That one getting underway at 8 p.m. UK time, and you can follow it on the BBC Sport website.
Mike, thanks very much for that. Let's get a word now from Paddy O'Connell.
Hello from the Royal Albert Hall. Behind me are the musicians and members of the armed forces gathering last night for rehearsals for a giant concert this evening. Join the Festival of Remembrance on Radio 2 from 8 p.m. tonight. Sir Tom Jones, who's performing, is our guest. His grandfather is buried in France, where he died in the First World War. We meet D-Day veterans and bereaved service families in advance of the Ceremony of Remembrance on Radio 4 from 10:30 tomorrow morning, when we will be live from the cenotaph with the 2 minute silence, radio's loudest sound.
It is indeed. It's just gone 7:30. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The senior US Democrat Nancy Pelosi has suggested President Biden is partly to blame for his party's election defeat to Donald Trump. Ms. Pelosi told the New York Times that if Mr. Biden had pulled out of the presidential race sooner, giving more time to find a replacement, the Democrats would have fared better. The Republicans are on the verge of a clean sweep as they inch closer to winning a majority in the House of Representatives, having already taken the Senate. The US government has brought charges against three people in connection with an alleged Iranian plot to assassinate Donald Trump and an American journalist. Officials say the plan was ordered by Tehran's Revolutionary Guards. Iran denies the claims. Senior US officials have said Washington will no longer accept the presence of Hamas representatives in Qatar after the Palestinian group rejected the latest proposals to achieve a ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage deal. The officials said the Qatari government had agreed to tell Hamas to close down its political office in Doha. Qatar has not confirmed this and Hamas has denied it. In Pakistan, a powerful bomb blast at a railway station in the western city of Quetta has killed 24 people and injured dozens more. Video footage shows scenes of chaos with bodies lying among the debris and part of the station roof hanging down. Police said a suicide bomber was responsible. A British-based DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading without telling its customers what's happened to the highly sensitive data they shared with it. Atlas Biomed has a registered address in London, although its company officers and major shareholder are Russian. Its website, where profiles of people's unique genetic makeup were stored, no longer works, and the company's last update on social media was over a year ago. A campaign group is urging hundreds of thousands of former university students to check if they're eligible for a refund from the student loans company. Figures released for the first time show a total of £184 million has been overpaid and could be claimed back.
Thanks very much, Alan. It's 25 to 8. Asda is the latest supermarket to warn there could be higher food prices after the Chancellor's budget announced those national insurance tax rises on employers. It joins Sainsbury's and M&S. The National Farmers Union is furious about the adjustments made to the agricultural property relief and warns that'll directly impact food prices too. A Treasury spokesperson said the government has had to make difficult choices to fix the foundations of the country. Will the budget push up your food prices? What impact will those changes then have on farmers? Let's talk to Andrew Opie, Director of Food and Sustainability at the British Retail Consortium, and Tom Bradshaw, President of the NFU, both on the line. Good morning to you both. Andrew, to come to you, first of all, how much is food going to go up by then?
It's impossible to give a proper figure, but if you think that retailers and the food industry have been disproportionately affected by this, because we're large employers of entry-level and part-time jobs, I think it's inevitable because of the scale of those costs and the fact that we've been fighting inflation for 3 years and have stripped all available costs out of the system, that prices will need to go up unless something really radical happens, like energy prices falling significantly, which I think is highly unlikely. So unfortunately, there's a lot of impact in this budget, both for businesses and customers.
But Sainsbury's made £690 million worth of profit last year. Tesco made over £2 billion worth of profit as well in the same time. Couldn't shareholders accept a bit less money?
Well, it's the scale of the changes. So we've calculated that for the supermarket sector, these changes, including some new changes for things like packaging coming in next year, are equivalent to about £3 billion plus. That's 60% of all the profit made by all the supermarkets in the UK. You cannot apply that level of charges and costs to an industry that is already operating on a 2 or 3% margin and not expect it to have an impact on prices.
But to that question, I understand the extra costs and it's important to outline that to our listeners. Couldn't there be some absorption by shareholders? Couldn't they take more on? Couldn't they shoulder more? We're being told about a black hole in our economy. You also know there's a cost of living crisis.
Absolutely. And it's those who are the poorest families that will feel the biggest impact from this, because poorest families spend... Because they spend the highest proportion of their income on...
No, I understand why they'll feel the biggest impact, but why should they?
Let me be clear about this. The CMA looked at grocery competition only a year ago, and it concluded that grocery competition in the UK is not only highly competitive and beneficial to consumers, but we also know we have the lowest food prices anywhere in Western Europe. That is because retailers and those in the food industry have had their margins squeezed over the last 3 years to try and get that affordability to every customer in the UK. Now, that cannot continue with a huge level of charges, around £3 billion coming on, and it not have an impact on prices.
Do you feel comfortable about that?
I don't feel comfortable about it. I mean, we are in business to make things as affordable and make the choice as great as possible for consumers.
But I just still don't think you've answered that question.
We are running businesses already absolutely at the threadbare margins. We are large.
But how can people hear it at threadbare margins if Tesco made over £2 billion in profit?
Because that's just because they sell a lot of stuff, basically. But the margin on it, and the margin we're able to pay farmers and our producers that produce the food, is absolutely tiny. And we're also trying to get the best back to about 1.5 million employees. We're trying to get the best back to consumers. So to try and then face another £3 billion worth of costs.
Let me bring in Tom, just to make sure we get a right of an insight, really, on the food providers here. Tom Bradshaw, what do you say to that about food prices?
Well, I believe this is a hugely inflationary budget for food production. Particularly if you look at the fresh produce sector, our horticulture producing vegetables and fruits, something like strawberries, the cost of production has probably gone up nearly 6% overnight on the 1st of April when these changes take effect. And we cannot absorb any more of this cost. The farming industry has nothing left to give. These last 5 years of volatility since COVID and then the Ukraine war means farmers have done everything they can to absorb any cost increases. But there is nothing left in the coffers. So it really has to go up the supply chain. And I just don't understand how this is a growth budget, because to me, it feels like it's an inflationary budget.
So, but what's your view on it's not for you to, or farmers rather, to absorb this? What about the idea of it shouldn't be passed on to consumers?
Well, I, unfortunately, for there to be a functioning supply chain where we can have long-term sustainability, there has to be fair returns coming down to our members. We don't set the prices at retail, but I do look, there's huge cost increases with this, with the changes to the living wage and national insurance. And it really is down to the retail sector to look at what they can do. But I'm afraid this time I do have some sympathy for what Andrew is saying, that there, these are monumental changes, huge increases. Now, it will be down to the retailers to see how much of that they can absorb. But what I know is our members have to pass their cost increases up the supply chain.
Some of your members are incredibly unhappy with you at the moment, though. If I could just draw your attention to another story that we were hearing about in our news bulletins. Farmers having to pay inheritance tax on estates worth more than £1 million has seen many farmers want to take to the streets later this month. You're organising an event to try and lobby MPs about this, but you're urging farmers not invited to that event to not come and make it a big protest. The Met Police, just to give this extra detail, deny that they've banned a protest. What's going on? Why can't farmers come to London and protest? Why is your union against this?
This has been absolutely misrepresented. We were always organising a mass lobby event in Westminster, originally for 600 members. We've increased the capacity to 1,800 members. The plan for that is that they sit down opposite their parliamentarian. They look them in the eyes. They talk from the heart about what this changed agricultural property relief means to them, their family, and the future of farming and food production. The MPs are the ones that ultimately have to change this. They have to be willing to stand up against the government and say, we will not support this cruel family farm tax. That is the event we were always organising.
Yes,
it's been
misrepresented. Why can't people take to the streets?
What we cannot do is take responsibility for people in the streets. There is now a complimentary event being organised by a group of farmers. We are supporting them. It is absolutely complimentary.
You are supporting them?
Yes, we are. Yeah, but it's not an NFU event. The NFU event is the mass lobbying.
Why can't
event.
You support both? I only ask this. It's important to hear what you have to say and what you're saying about it being misrepresented. It's because looking in the Telegraph today, a high profile farmer has told the Telegraph it was typical of the NFU, your organisation, to make lots of noise, but then not want to be part of any disruption or protest in case as an organisation they are held liable. He goes on to say, their model, your model, is to have nice meetings and gatherings, to have a chat and a moan with each other, and then go and talk to the government. Why not support both?
So what we are organising our event, and we are cooperating and working with the other event, but we are not taking responsibility for the other event. Otherwise, we will not get in front of parliamentarians. Ours has to be a very controlled environment so that parliamentarians feel safe that they will want to meet with their constituents.
Gareth Wynne-Jones, a TV farmer and campaigner, said people are getting frustrated with your quiet lobbying in the face of pressures on the industry. Something radical needs to be done. Are you not stepping up in the way that you should at a time that you should?
I mean, I cannot believe anybody can say this. After the last 10 days, where I've probably done 50 media interviews, we've been all over the press, all over the papers, but we also have to be solutions focused. I don't just want to moan. I want to sort the problem.
All right,
to sort the problem, we have to be with government.
We're out of time, but hopefully you feel you got that across. Tom Bradshaw, Andrew Opie, thank you.
16 minutes to 8. Let's get some more on that missing DNA we heard about in the headlines, because customers who used a DNA testing firm to trace ancestry or potential vulnerability to certain conditions and diseases have been left feeling pretty vulnerable themselves, as the company appears to have gone out of business without telling those customers what's happened to their sensitive data. BBC's technology editor Zoe Kleinman is on the line. Morning, Zoe. Tell us some more.
Morning, Simon. I've been covering 23andMe, which is another very well-known US-based DNA testing service. It's one of those ones where you send off a sample of your saliva and you get back a report telling you about your ancestry and also telling you a bit about your genetic makeup, you know, what diseases you might be more predisposed to, and even perhaps what injuries you might be more likely to suffer badly from because of your unique DNA. And the lady got in touch with me and said she had sent her saliva to a UK-based company called Atlas Biomed, offering a very similar service, but it kept the profile that you sent online. And it said as it gathered more data and identified more genetic information, it would add that to your profile. So it would keep updating you on this very unique and personal information about yourself. But she said the company had disappeared. And I started looking into it, and I have to say, she was right. The website is inactive. Social media hasn't been updated for more than a year. The phone number is dead. We went to two of the addresses that are listed for it in London. One had never heard of it, and the other was the address for the firm which had registered it and said it was legitimately using that address, but it wasn't actually there. Didn't reply to emails or LinkedIn messages. The phone number didn't work. So this company does appear to have vanished. And what I also don't know as a result of that is where everybody's DNA database is now.
Yeah, and like you say, this is sensitive information. You'd think a sector like this would be much more regulated. There'd be some requirements that you know, some safeguarding of this kind of information.
I mean, there are. We have a UK version of GDPR, which is the data protection law. And that's we also have a regulator called the Information Commissioner's Office, which confirmed to me that it has had a complaint about Atlas Biomed and it is investigating. What I didn't expect, Simon, as I was following this trail, was that it led me to Moscow. I found four names of people who are still listed on Companies House as being actively involved in the firm. And quite a few of them share an address in Russia. One of them is a Russian billionaire. Now, I don't know what that tells us about this company, which Companies House says is still registered as active. Its accounts are overdue, but it has not closed down. But I think you're absolutely right. It is a cautionary tale, isn't it, about handing over this data that's unique to you. You can't change it. It identifies your biological strengths and weaknesses, and also, kind of by default, that of your close family, because you are going to share similar traits.
Yeah, it's super interesting, this sort of area, isn't it? Because in the old days, you wouldn't know which 10 people out of 100 were going to drop dead, but you just knew that the actuaries would tell you that 10 of them would do so before the age of 70. But nowadays, we actually kind of do know which 10 people are most susceptible to certain things. That's what makes this information so sensitive.
It's so sensitive and it's also so attractive, isn't it? You know, who doesn't want to know all the sort of information about ourselves? There was a real trend for it a few years ago, wasn't there? People sending off to find out more about their ancestry and finding out all kinds of incredible things about their lives and where they'd come from. These companies are starting to struggle a bit now though, Simon, because the business model was very hard to sustain. It's a bit of a one-off, isn't it? You pay your money, yeah. You send off your saliva, you get your report and then you're kind of done. And that's what 23andMe is now finding. And I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what these other companies are doing now that everybody has sort of been there and done it. But yeah. This data is extremely valuable and really should be kept safe.
Yeah, well, it sounds like this other company, Atlas Biomed, has come to the end of the road prematurely, but I know you'll stay on the case. Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, thank you.
12 minutes to 8. It is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Rev Dawn Colley, Methodist Minister for the Royal Air Force.
Good morning. As the 11th hour of the 11th month approaches, I wonder what this time of remembrance means to you. As an RAF chaplain, I've spent Remembrance Day in many places. I've served alongside military personnel from the UK and other nations, and witnessed the multitude of graves to those who have fallen in times of war. Tomorrow I'll be preaching at Christchurch Cathedral in Stanley. I remember as a child hearing about the conflict over the Falklands and asking, where are they? And what have they got to do with me? As you drive through the islands, you pass numerous memorials. Names such as Goose Green, Ajax Bay and San Carlos resonate through history. There's also the Argentine Cemetery, containing graves marked with individual white crosses. For the people for whom this is home, it's important to remember and give thanks for their freedom and right to self-determination. At the Liberation Monument, funded entirely by the islanders, the inscription reads, "In memory of those who liberated us." It's easy to be complacent about our lives today, our freedom and liberty. It's easy to forget the cost. Being here reinforces the importance of telling our story, to remember the cost, to remember the cause. And it's crucial that we remember all those who have died in times of war. So what would I answer the questions of my 9-year-old self today? To the question of what have the Falkland Islands got to do with me, I'd answer that as a human being and a child of God, we seek to preserve life and freedom of humanity. We're called to love our neighbour, even if they are on the other side of the globe. That we're called to take responsibility for each other. And this continues after war, in times of restoration and times of peace. Whilst we remember our history, recognise that in our present day, security and peace is fragile, we must also remember to hope for the future. Hope is an act of faith. In the same way as Reveille sounds after the last post, recognising that today is a day of hope and opportunity, we're called to remember the goodness in life. We remember with gratitude that our lives today are possible due to the actions of those who have gone before us. We should also remember that our actions today have an effect for generations to come.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dawn Colley, Methodist Minister from the Royal Air Force. It is 8 minutes, very nearly to eight. Now, when the northern leg of HS2, the bit that was supposed to connect Birmingham and Manchester, was cancelled by the last government due to cost overruns on the southern leg, there were cries that the north had been betrayed. The whole point, or largely the whole point, of HS2 was connecting those cities with high-speed links. Now, the Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, has said a privately funded rail link is a perfectly viable option to explore. Proposals for the line were published by the mayors of Greater Manchester and the West Midlands, Andy Burnham and Richard Parker, Richard Parker joins me now, as does Mark Reynolds, Chief Executive of the Mace Group, the construction firm which has done some analysis on its feasibility. Good morning to you both. Richard Parker, first of all, Labour Mayor of West Midlands. Before we do the how, let's do the why. What is the case that you're making for why something has to be built?
Well, firstly, I'm really pleased with the new report. It's a far more pragmatic, I think, and practical way forward. But the real case it's building, which I think was different to previously, was this is now about reducing the demand and the current congestion, particularly on the M6 and the West Coast Main Line, which is holding our regions back and holding our economies back. So this is a really, I think, positive step forward, and it has the potential to make a big difference to deliver around £70 billion with additional growth to our regional economies. It will help connect two of the largest city regions in the country. It will give more of our people opportunities and access to more jobs, and it will allow businesses and investors to draw on a bigger pool of talent. So it's, I think, a really positive step forward.
And why this privately funded model? It sounds like the PFI, the privately funded initiative of the Brown government, where basically someone else builds it, the private sector builds it, and you rent it off them for decades to come. And those turned out to be terrible value for money.
Well, I really want to focus on the government's interest in moving this concept and idea forward. And I want to compliment the work led by Arup and Mace in actually proposing this solution. But it's more than just a privately financed line. It recognises that any new rail line needs to be underwritten by government. But more importantly, we're trying to bring, or they're recommending, that we bring together those disciplines of a privately financed project to bear, including more effective assessment of risk, far tighter project management, and stricter lines of accountability and governance. And if we can bring those disciplines to this leg of the project, we can deliver it, as the report says, at between 60 and 75% of the previous estimates, and we can deliver 80% or 85% of the benefits.
Well, let's drill into some of this. Mark Reynolds, Chief Executive of Mace, good morning. How much is this going to cost?
Well, we're estimating it's going to save at least £2 billion.
So, £2 billion off what? So what's the actual cost?
The cost, the estimate, I don't have exact figures to those, and it'd probably be inappropriate for me to decide those, because it'll have...
Well, you've got to be able, if you can give me a saving of £2 billion, you must know what you're subtracting from what.
Well, we're certainly subtracting from the scheme is not exactly the scheme. So let's be clear, some elements of this Trans-Pennine route upgrade has been approved and being delivered from the airport into Piccadilly Station. The main area we've been focusing on is looking at how we can actually reduce the track line area. So that is the phase two element. So right. What we've looked at is the elevation of the train, and the savings we've looked to make is really in, there's been a phrase around specification reduction. We haven't done that at all. What we've looked at is how we can reduce the speed, how we can make the tunnels much smaller. As you said, is how we look at the interfaces within the existing rail network. And more importantly, how we can actually deliver a track speed, which whilst is slightly slower.
Slower than HS2?
Yes, yes, by 60 kilometres.
Okay, that's quite a big chunk. Is the land still there? I mean, how closely would this resemble the cancelled HS2 project? It would be totally different.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. And this is one of the pleasing things of the announcements, is it's safeguarding the current route. And that's important, because if we want to deliver this at pace, which is what the government are looking to do, and we want to get involved quickly, we want to use the safeguarded route, the land that's been already provided.
Okay, and so you need to get a building before that, whilst that land is still available.
You need to safeguard the land so that we can build, so that we can get planning permission, so that we can do the site studies, and then we can progress with the works.
Richard Parker, how do you stop cost overruns? They ballooned out of control with HS2. A lot of people said they dug a lot of tunnels through Tory Shire so people couldn't see the trains go by. What's the secret to doing it this way, and how can you, and what happens next?
Well, that's on that point, you're absolutely right. The government decided to bury the line between London and Birmingham. I think you see daylight for 7 minutes. That comes at a terrific cost. I think this approach is far more practical. It will deliver the benefits we've discussed. But the next steps are the most important ones. This is largely a desktop study using data that is currently there. The next stage is, and I'm hoping with Andy Burnham to meet the Transport Secretary over the next 2 weeks, we can agree to put the steering group in place, and that will start and commence the next stage of very important work, which is more technical feasibility work and financial analysis. And that is a very important stage to building on the very good work, I must say, that's been done already.
Mark Reynolds, Chief Executive. Sorry, but Richard Parker, first of all, Mayor of West Midlands, you were just hearing there. And Mark Reynolds, the Chief Executive of Mace. Thank you both.
I'm Zoe Kleinman, the BBC's technology editor. And in this new series for Radio 4, I meet the moderators trying to manage the worst excesses of the internet.
The content sticks with you. The hardest part of content moderation, in my view, is the images of things that have really happened.
And explore the impact this job has on those who do it.
Sometimes after even just a few weeks or months of viewing this content day in, day in and out, they started to develop long-term mental health consequences.
The Moderators with me, Zoe Kleinman. Next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now with another dose of anti-cyclonic gloom, here's Elizabeth Rizzini from the BBC Weather Centre.
Thank you. It's my least favourite type of weather, I think. It is set to continue again today, though, for many of us, especially across England, Wales and Northern Ireland. But for Scotland, again, we should see some sunshine, so it's not gloomy everywhere. And it will turn a bit brighter tomorrow, I think, and distinctly sunnier across the board, actually, into the start of next week. So changes on its way. Today, it's a little bit chillier than it has been over the last few days, so cooler than this time yesterday. There's some quite stubborn mist and fog across parts of northwest Scotland, and that will continue to lift and clear as we head through the morning. Certainly some mist and some hill fog elsewhere too, creating a bit of drizzle from the thickness of the cloud. Lots of low cloud. It's another rather dreary looking day. The anti-cyclonic gloom just set to continue, I'm afraid. Some brighter spells developing across northwest Wales and northwest England, perhaps through the afternoon. And then across Scotland, I think, again, it will brighten up, particularly across parts of Fife and across the far north and the west as well. Temperature-wise, we're between 8 and 10 degrees Celsius for the vast majority today, so a bit chillier than it has been. And 11 to 14 degrees for Northern Ireland, Wales and parts of western Scotland. It will be a bit brighter tomorrow, but also with some patchy rain and drizzle, particularly in the north and the west.
Thanks very much for brightening us up there slightly. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 9th of November. The headlines this morning: the veteran US Democrat politician Nancy Pelosi has said President Biden must shoulder some of the blame for his party's crushing defeat by Donald Trump. A DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading, raising concerns about what has happened to customers' highly sensitive personal data. And a campaign group says thousands of former university students could be eligible for a refund because of overpayment on their loans.
There you go. Coming up in the next hour.
Sign up. Sign up now. Sign up here for the sign.
Walter Tull, thought to be the first Afro-Caribbean officer in the British Army, signed up for the Somme and paid the ultimate price. A campaign to get him in the military honours he was denied at the time has been set to music. It never was the end of history, of course, but what next for the liberal world order? We'll be hearing from the historians Simon Sharma and Timothy Garton Ash. And Beyoncé, now not just the most Grammy-nominated artist in history, she's also the queen of people's choices on Desert Island Discs.
Tell me about your eighth disc, Jimmy Carr. What are we going to hear?
I think this is maybe the best pop record ever.
Yeah, he's not wrong. It doesn't matter which one, to be honest. And having had the privilege of seeing her once in concert, she was extraordinary. All will be revealed before 9 o'clock.
Good morning from Mike Williams with the Saturday Sport. Ireland lose their opening Rugby Autumn Nations Series match to New Zealand in Dublin, whilst England are looking for their first victory later. They meet Australia at Twickenham. Meanwhile, in football, we hear from fan-turned-writer who's so vexed about VAR, she's written a book about it.
I think the point I'm making is VAR's a dead end. I don't think you will have something very similar to VAR in 20 years' time. I think you'll end up with something that looks very different. I think football's authorities need to start thinking a bit more radically about what comes next.
Big discussion that. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The former Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has partly blamed President Biden for the Democrats' bruising election defeat, suggesting they would have fared better if he'd pulled out of the race sooner. Ms. Pelosi is said to have played a key role in persuading Mr. Biden to end his re-election bid, but she told the New York Times her party could have used more time to choose his replacement. The Democrats are involved in a public post-mortem after losing hold of the White House and potentially control of both chambers of Congress, as Samir Hussain reports from Washington.
Now that the election is over, the recriminations have begun in the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House and one of the most influential people in the party, largely blamed U.S. President Joe Biden for the Democrats' crushing defeat. In an interview with the New York Times, Ms. Pelosi said, had he stepped aside earlier, there could have been other candidates in the race. As Democrats lick their wounds, Republicans are on the verge of a clean sweep, already winning the presidency and control of the Senate. They are just 6 votes shy of winning the House of Representatives. That kind of political power gives President-elect Donald Trump free rein to enact the policies he sees fit. One person who might shape his agenda is the billionaire Elon Musk, who joined Mr. Trump in a phone call with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Iran has rejected American claims that it recruited a man to assassinate Donald Trump. The U.S. Justice Department has charged Faraj Shakeri, who it says told police he was instructed to kill the president-elect last month. He's now believed to be in Iran. Senior U.S. officials have said Washington no longer accepts the presence of Hamas representatives in Qatar, the American ally, which has played a major role in the fruitless talks to try to broker a ceasefire in Gaza and free Israeli hostages. The anonymous officials said Hamas's leaders should not be welcome in the capitals of any U.S. partner after they rejected the latest proposal. Joe Inwood sent this report from Jerusalem.
Qatar has played a key diplomatic role in trying to bring an end to this conflict. As well as taking part in talks, it's hosted the political office of Hamas, allowing the group to operate with relative freedom. But the message from Washington is that that agreement must come to an end. Speaking anonymously, a senior U.S. official said Hamas's rejection of another ceasefire and hostage deal was the final straw. They added the message had been delivered to Hamas 10 days ago. Qatar has yet to respond to the reports. 3 Hamas officials have said they are untrue. But this comes from a U.S. administration soon to be out of power. President Biden may want to secure a deal in his final months. Everyone else around the table knows he will soon be replaced. And it is Donald Trump they will have to deal with.
A UK-based DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading without telling its customers, raising concerns about what's happened to their data. Atlas Biomed used saliva samples to profile people's unique genetic makeup, but its website no longer works and the firm's last update on social media was over a year ago. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Atlas Biomed's accounts are long overdue, according to Companies House, but the firm is still listed as being active. It has 2 public addresses in London, which the BBC visited. One had never heard of the DNA testing company, and the second was home to the firm which registered it, but not Atlas Biomed itself. 2 of its remaining officers share an address in Moscow, according to their filings, along with a 3rd man, a major shareholder who is also a Russian billionaire. The data watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, confirmed that it had received a complaint about the company. Customers the BBC spoke to said they were worried about their data and annoyed they'd paid for a service they could no longer access. Privacy experts urge caution around sharing DNA samples for profiling, as it's such deeply personal and valuable information, and sharing it also impacts close relatives who are likely to have similar traits.
Metropolitan Police has denied claims that farmers have been banned from protesting in London about government plans to remove an exemption from inheritance tax for some. Farmers and their supporters claimed they'd been prevented from holding a rally on November the 19th because of what they called two-tier policing, which favoured pro-Palestinian protests. But Scotland Yard said it would work with anyone who wanted to protest peacefully. Metropolitan Police is to be investigated over its handling of sex abuse complaints against Mohammed Al-Fayed. The Met has referred itself to the Independent Office for Police Conduct after 2 women raised concerns about the quality of the police response. The Met has said it'll transparently address any failings. Here's Daniel DeSimone.
Since a BBC documentary in September heard testimony from former Harrods employees who said the billionaire sexually assaulted or raped them, the Met Police has been forced to reveal it has found reports from 21 women who went to the force about Al-Fayed between 2005 and his death in 2023. The force is examining its handling of the claims and has now passed two of the cases to the IOPC for review after the two women concerned complained in recent weeks. The complaints, involving investigations from 2008 and 2013, relate to the quality of the Met's response and, in the 2013 case, how details about it came to be disclosed publicly.
A campaign group is urging hundreds of thousands of former university students to check if they're eligible for a refund from the student loans company. Figures released for the first time show a total of £184 million has been overpaid. Here's Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox.
Former students have to start repaying their loans when they earn above a certain amount in any given tax year. That earnings threshold is different depending which repayment plan people are on. The main reason so much money is available to be claimed back is because repayments were taken from people despite them not earning above that annual threshold. This can happen if they work extra shifts or get a bonus, which pushes their pay up for a month or two, but which then drops down again for the rest of the year. A new digital scheme launched in May, which allows people to claim back these overpayments online, has so far been used by more than 400,000 people. But Save the Student is still urging anyone who thinks they may be eligible to check their account with a student loans company.
More than 30 firefighters, police officers and other public servants who've died in the line of duty have become the first to posthumously receive a new award in recognition of their sacrifice. Among those honoured with the Elizabeth emblem are PCs Fiona Bone and Nicola Hughes, who were killed in an ambush in 2012. PC Hughes' father, Bryn, led the campaign for people like his daughter to be recognised.
Not only just Nicola and Fiona, but other police officers. They go to work every day and they're serving the Crown and they're wearing a crown on their uniform, and quite rightly so, they should be recognised by the Crown, by the state. And I think that's important, that they are recognised.
Space historians are trying to establish why the UK's oldest satellite appears to be in the wrong part of the sky. The military spacecraft known as Skynet 1A was launched in 1969, but the records detailing when and why it got moved have been lost. Jonathan Amos has the story.
Shortly after man landed on the moon, British forces entered the space age by getting their first telecommunications satellite. Sited high above East Africa, Skynet 1A allowed London to talk securely with personnel as far away as Singapore. For several years it worked well, but when it died, the satellite spawned a mystery. Had it failed in place, it would now be drifting over the Indian Ocean, but it's actually sitting over Central America. Official records have been lost, but historians think the United States Air Force might have commanded some late manoeuvres. If that's true, they did the UK few favours, because they left Skynet 1A in a part of the sky where it risks running into today's operational satellites. And 50 years on, Britain is still responsible for the abandoned spacecraft.
And the man who voiced one of the most recognisable sounds of the internet's early days, AOL's You've Got Mail alert, has died. Elwood Edwards was 74. Here's Rory Gallimore.
The internet was in its infancy in 1989, and the company that would eventually become AOL wanted to give its software a friendly voice.
Welcome.
That voice was Elwood Edwards. He'd been working various jobs at a local TV station when his wife volunteered him to record several greetings for the tech firm. Edwards used a cassette disc from his own living room.
You've got pictures. You've got mail.
The gig was not lucrative. He was paid $200. But as AOL grew, those words would be heard many millions of times a day worldwide.
That was Rory Gallimore.
Thanks very much, Alan. It's 11 minutes past eight. As America and the world prepares for President Trump, the sequel, how will he deal with the war in Ukraine is one of the top issues in his foreign policy entree. Curiously, unconventionally, during his first call with the Ukrainian president, Mr. Zelensky, since winning the election, Mr. Trump was joined by one of his most famous and certainly his richest supporter, Elon Musk, who is expected to play an influential role in his administration and was reported to have been handed the phone during that exchange. The call was reported to have lasted 25 minutes. That's according to the news outlet Axios, which first reported the story and the inclusion of Mr. Musk. And the president-elect is understood to have told the Ukrainian leader he will continue to support its mission. But there are no further details. It's understood President Zelensky thanked Elon Musk during their part of the call for the satellites he'd been providing to Ukraine through his company Starlink. But the billionaire's relationship with the Ukrainian government is checkered, with Mr. Musk having ridiculed President Zelensky for asking for Western aid every 5 minutes, and then top Ukrainian politicians having fired back on X, the social media network owned by Elon Musk, for spreading Russian propaganda. It's also been reported in the Wall Street Journal that Elon Musk has been in regular contact with Vladimir Putin since 2022. On the campaign trail, you may remember, Mr. Trump said he could solve the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Well, in a moment on that and other issues, we'll hear from the former defense secretary of this country, Ben Wallace. But first, to get a sense of Elon Musk's potential role in the new US administration, let's listen to what Ross Gerber, the chief executive and president of Gerber Kawasaki, Wealth and Investment, who was previously one of Elon Musk's biggest backers, but has turned into one of his biggest critics since the billionaire took over X, which was known as Twitter, what he has to say. Here's his reaction to Musk pairing up with President-elect Donald Trump.
It is an odd couple at best and certainly crazy at worst. So, you know, welcome to the new world. He's kind of like Trump's brain, you know. So like Trump, you know, isn't really good at stuff. So having Elon, you know, working the brain side for him is not a bad outcome it's better than Trump trying to deal with these issues. I would say give these people a chance, and if they fail, then we can criticize them. But I'm not going to go into a new country, a new election with a negative hope.
He's Trump's brain. Simon Jack here, my colleague, has been speaking to Kara Swisher, a tech reporter who's covered Silicon Valley's business giants for years, about how we should understand Elon Musk's role in this new administration.
I think it's disturbing that an unelected richest man in the world gets to make policy just for buying his way into the White House, essentially.
What's in it for Elon?
The money. Like, I'm sorry. It's just, I think it's a lot of money and it's a lot of power, and he's got some points of view, and he's, you know, he's got it. Obviously, he's a narcissist, and so he thinks he knows better about how to run the world. And he's always been very dramatic about the world. When he was talking to me about Tesla, he says, he told me if Tesla didn't survive, all humanity was doomed, which I thought was a little dramatic. It's just a car. But he has that kind of point of view that without him, we are all doomed, essentially. It's weird, honestly.
Is there any upside to this? Some people have talked about him as being Trump's brain. Is there some merit to him being Trump's brain, given that he's, by all accounts, and you know, irrefutably a smart guy?
Yeah, he's a smart guy, but there's a lot of smart people in the world. You know, this idea that this one person knows everything is ridiculous. He's not a political brain. He has no political expertise. He has no foreign expertise. He has no economic expertise. He's good at making cars and shooting rockets up in the sky. So, okay.
He's also been earmarked for some role in government spending, the Department for Government Efficiency. What do you make of that prospect?
Also disturbing, because the way he does efficiency at his own companies, he just fires people and he doesn't pay their severance. Or he makes, you know, there's all kinds of lawsuits around safety at his factories. And so it's very easy when you're running a factory to do this thing. And it's a very different thing when you just decide to cut the National Weather Service and we can't forecast hurricanes. People's lives are at stake. He's always resisted government regulation. So it's, you know, you're putting the fox in the hen house, essentially.
Trump has a habit of cooling on people. One minute you're the darling, and the next minute you're cast out.
That's one of his greatest traits, frankly. I think I kind of like it. It's so, you know, I do think there'll probably be a clash here because, again, there's a movie that's one of my favorites called Highlander, and I always say there can be only one, you know?
I know it.
There can be only one, and guess who that one is? It's not Elon Musk. It's Donald Trump.
Kara, thanks so much. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The tech reporter Kara Swisher there. Let's talk now to Ben Wallace, the former defence secretary. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could we just start with your reaction, with your experience of the decision to hand the phone to Elon Musk in this first call with President Zelensky since Trump's election?
Well, I mean, first of all, he hasn't taken office yet. And if you and so there are conversations usually in private with an administration coming in. People that want to understand an administration or get close to it, often, you know, it's a more, you know, it's a less structured environment. So I don't think we should be so surprised at one level. And also, if you add that to how Donald Trump does business, you know, he is unconventional by nature. We learned that in the last 4 years he was president. So I'm not effectively surprised, but I'll be very interested to see what role Elon Musk plays when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of making sure that you know, Putin fails in Ukraine, or that his invasion is not rewarded, and indeed Ukraine is able under its terms to make a settlement if that is Ukraine's wish. And I think that will be very, very important. We don't know the details of the full call. And let's face it, neither side will probably tell us most of it. You'll get the sort of skimmed summary.
But I suppose it's just that concern when and the not knowing of what Donald Trump will do, and then the concern about potential relationships with Putin, both Trump's relationships with Putin and also Elon Musk's, as has been reported.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we're going to have to be better at as the UK is going to have to really lean in and invest in that relationship with Donald Trump, whatever the current government has previously thought of him. You know, the best way to mitigate unpredictability is to hug them close and be as close as possible.
Are you concerned about it?
I have the experience of the withdrawal of Afghanistan and the Afghan deal, which, you know, was more about a pan-US failing. I mean, it was started by Donald Trump, the deal, if you remember back at the time. But then Joe Biden came in and lifted all conditions, and we ended up with the mess that we saw in Kabul. And I think it's more of a trend rather than specifically Donald Trump. Donald Trump is much more explicit about effectively more isolationism, no American boots on the ground, and withdrawing globally from the world. But we've seen the other side of the aisle, the Democrats, trend fairly similarly. And so I think concerned.
You don't think there's going to be a major departure in the way that Donald Trump handles Ukraine? I mean,
way will be different. Absolutely.
Go on. So what do you think on that?
As we've already seen, the way will be he'll try and lead it himself. He'll be less reliant on the deep state, as he calls it. I mean, he's already done, I think, a piece to camera about how he's going to dismantle what he views as the deep state. So he'll be less reliable, I think, on the traditional networks of diplomats and others. And he will try and do it in person. If you remember when he went to North Korea for a few seconds, but he went to South Korea, remember he met Kim Jong-un.
Yes.
He was going to sort all that out, and he stepped across the border. I think poor old Secret Service had a heart attack. I think he will try and do it that way. Now, the thing is, President Zelensky is also, in his own right, a powerful and an individual man, and he will have his views, and he represents, you know, the families of tens of thousands of Ukrainians who have died to defend themselves. And as British history itself knows, we're not, you know, when push comes to shove and you're fighting for your survival, you're not always going to take advice from a third country, no matter how important they are to you, because you're surviving. And I think that's going to be the most interesting part.
But I suppose it's interesting as well to see on the front page of The Guardian this morning, this report, we mentioned it earlier, that officials have been talking to journalists at the paper saying Ukraine's relationship with the UK has got worse since the Labour government took power in July. And there's frustration over Britain's failure to supply those extra long range missiles. You'll be very familiar with this. But if there is, as some are concerned about, an America that's turning back towards itself, the idea of Britain stepping up more, Europe stepping up more, is front of mind at the moment. So I suppose it's whether you think, and what you think could happen on that front.
Well, first of all, I think I wouldn't use the word worse. What has happened is the leadership that Britain showed right from the start has started to drop back into the sort of pack. And there are officials in the Foreign Office who often lobby, and did in my time, to say, well, we don't want to get ahead of the pack. In other words, we don't want to have any leadership. We just want to sort of dwell in the middle. And the reason we did many of the weapon systems was to take a lead, because we took a decision across party, the Labour Party, the SNP, and the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives all agreed in Parliament this was the right thing to do. We took a position to lead, and the leadership did bring lots and lots of Europeans with us. Everyone in Europe really is, most of them, apart from Hungary, on side. And I definitely have a sense that that momentum has dropped back. And my experience of government is if you want to really drive things, you have to really do it every single day. You can't just do a statement and then float around. You know, I know of companies who have had applications into the Foreign Office for an export license for equipment to help Ukraine, and they still haven't been processed 6 months later. You know, that doesn't sound like a government that wants to help Ukraine if its bureaucracy in the Foreign Office is holding up some pretty basic technologies that Ukrainians need to make their own weapon systems to defend their nation.
We're going to have to leave it there. I mean, the latest line just on the commitment is to, from Labour, is to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence. A similar commitment made by the previous government, by your government, Conservative government of April of this year, to increase by 2030. We don't actually know when that commitment will be made by, but it's very useful to get your take on the New World Order. I'm so sorry, but Ben Wallace, we're going to have to
briefly on that. Remember last week we got a cut in our defence budget because Labour artificially inflated it by putting the £3 billion for Ukraine into the bottom line. And that doesn't bode well. But if it's 2.5%, I will welcome it. But it's got to be real money with a timetable.
That's the commitment. Ben Wallace, thank you.
23 minutes past eight. Walter Tull was a remarkable figure. He was one of the first non-white players in top flight football. He was the son of a Barbadian carpenter and Alice, who was from Kent. And in 1917, he became one of the first mixed race infantry officers in a regular British Army regiment and was recommended for a military cross, an award he never received, many believe down to racism, because he died in 1918. Today, a petition is calling for him to receive that recognition, posthumously, and the campaign is being highlighted on a musical tour called Our Little Hour. Here's a little snatch of it.
Sign up now, sign up here for the sign.
For the team that'll take all in its stride. Answer your men are calling clarion. Sign with the football.
That's from Our Little Hour about the life of Walter Tull. We can speak to Ed Finlayson, who is a great nephew of Walter Tull, and also Susie Broadbent, musical director and member of the cast of that thing you just heard there. She played Walter's mother, Alice. Good morning to you both. Ed, you're clearly a remarkable figure he was. What are you most proud of, and what do you think people should know about him?
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to take part in this. Well, as a family, we're very proud of our granduncle for the reasons that you've described, his achievements in the face of great adversity. He lost his mother when he was seven, his father when he was nine, and admitted to a children's home in East London, and then separated from my grandfather, who was adopted by a Glasgow couple. So he had a very rough time in his childhood, but nevertheless achieved what you've described. Mm. And we're very proud of his achievements.
And you say proud of his achievements in the face of difficult odds. Are you talking about his mixed race status and how he had to be a trailblazer both in sport and indeed in the army?
I think undeniably that must have been the case. We know from football paper articles of the time, renownedly the game against Bristol, when he received tremendous abuse that was actually criticised in the football press, which is quite remarkable. Mm. And, you know, in the army, you were not allowed to take on officer training if you were not of pure European descent, which Walter was not, and yet he did undertake officer training and led British troops, which was quite unique.
Susie Broadbent, what themes did you want to bring out in the piece of work that you were the musical director and member of the cast of? Hello, Susie, are you there? No, we don't have Susie. We'll go back to Ed. Do you think, so, Ed, would you like to him to have received... He didn't receive the honour that he was recommended for, the Military Cross.
Yes.
Would you like to have seen that awarded posthumously? What is the campaign, what is the petition exactly trying to achieve?
Well, as a family, we're proud of our granduncle's achievements, so we don't need a further medal. That won't change. But I believe that the award of the medal posthumously is of great importance. If simply to acknowledge he was definitely recommended for the Military Cross, that is not in any doubt. And I think to award it would make a statement that he was not deprived of the medal simply because he was of mixed heritage. Mm. And I think that's a very important message that should be made.
I think Susie Broadbent is now on the line. Can you hear? Oh, no, we've lost her again. What are the things that you think, what are the lessons from his life that you would like, that themes that... And well, you know, have you seen the musical, presumably? What did the audience make of it? What did they take home?
I thought the musical was very moving. It certainly moved me, and I have to say I'm instinctively not a musical fan. I thought it was a fantastic piece of work. Susie and her colleague actors were magnificent. I thought the whole production was superb. In terms of Walter, I think he demonstrated great resilience, great commitment, perseverance in a life that must have been full of adversity. And the photographs we have of him show a man that looks at ease with himself and the world, relaxed, enjoying the company of my grandfather, his older brother.
OK. Well, thank you for telling us about him, Ed Finlayson. Oh, we do have Susie, I'm told. Are you there?
I am here.
You're there. Hooray. just briefly, I'm afraid, if we could just... What are the themes you wanted to bring out of this, and what were you trying to the audience to take away with them?
Well, Dougie Blaxland, the writer, and Chris Anthony, the composer, really wanted to bring the amazing life of Walter Tull to audiences and get as many people as possible to sign that petition. And I think they've just done a brilliant job. So anyone listening, please do sign that petition, because he is just the most inspirational man.
OK. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're glad we got you in the end. Susie Broadbent there. And before that, Ed Finlayson, great nephew of the remarkable Walter Tull. Thank you both.
Well, it's 29 minutes past eight. Mike's here with the sport.
Thank you, Emma. Chatting football this hour, and in particular about the three little letters that have been the cause of some of the most contentious debates in the sport for the past 5 years. Can you guess what they are?
Scrap it! Scrap VAR, because it's worthless, pointless, a total waste of time!
You know, the feedback we've had from people within the game is that this is a pretty subjective situation, it's split opinion, so on that basis the VAR followed the right course.
It's a joke! We've gone about VAR this, VAR that. Help the officials out, give them all the help they need, because clearly it costs us 2 points a day. It's a joke!
We, of course, talk of the vexatious VAR. The Video Assistant Referee System has been in use in English football for 5 years now and continues to be as divisive as when it first arrived. So much so that the author, Daisy Christodoulou, has written a book titled simply, I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR. Well, I sat down with her earlier this week and asked her how she felt VAR has changed football.
I think VAR has changed it for the worst. I go to a lot of live matches, and I do think it has made a difference in the way that fans celebrate goals and even the way players celebrate goals. You've lost that element of spontaneous joy, and I don't think that's great. And I think what we've realised is that the spontaneity of football, it's a very fluid game, there aren't many natural breaks. All of those things are quite important. And maybe we knew that before, but we didn't know it in the same way we know now. And I also think the way that it's been introduced, I think it's been quite heavy-handed. The authorities have been slow to respond to some of the obvious problems. So I do think there are ways you could do things better. You could go one way and say, look, let's just get rid of VAR. We've tried it. It's been 5 years. You can't call it teething problems anymore. We've tried it. It's not working out. Let's just go back and not have it. And it's really striking that in Sweden, they've chosen not to have it. So there are people saying we've had enough. Wolverhampton Wanderers tabled the motion in the summer to get rid of it.
But that was defeated 19-1.
It was defeated. It was. And I think that's because the English clubs want to be doing the same as whatever most other clubs in Europe are doing, and I get that. The other thing you can do is say, look, it needs some really radical change. And one of the things I say in the book is there's a lot of ways in which VAR is not that technologically sophisticated. There's a lot of ways in which it's just introducing another human to look at the incident again and scrutinise it. And actually that just adds in a lot more subjectivity and doubt and confusion. So the other way you could go is to use more advanced technology and come up with a piece of technology that is a bit more of a decision assist for the referee, that is giving you some kind of percentage probability a particular incident is a foul. The way it's been introduced has alienated a lot of fans.
And I think the referee's checking it. He's checking VAR.
What is he checking?
Aguero could be offside when that ball goes into him.
Oh, this is massive. Well, the referee is still talking away, so the goal hasn't been given yet. Oh, the referee has given the signal.
Offside!
The rectangle in the air.
Given offside!
The goal's ruled out. Oh, what incredible drama. It remains 4-3 to Manchester City.
I was struck in the book, in your chapter called Transparency, you make a comparison between VAR and the Freedom of Information Act passed in the 2000s by then Prime Minister Tony Blair. You say freedom of information is the political equivalent of a slow motion replay. Does greater transparency improve decision making?
Yes, so I spent a whole chapter on this because I think it is an important issue. The point Blair talked about is that you can end up with a chilling effect where people don't speak about the things they want to. They just sort of kind of clam up because they know it will be released and might be used against them. So, look, I would say on balance, I am in favour of transparency. And I think that transparency probably is a prerequisite for improving things. And I think you can see in some examples that's already happened in football. So I thought it was interesting when the Luis Diaz goal that was ruled out offside.
This is a Tottenham last
year. Yeah, Tottenham versus Liverpool last season. That was a big VAR error. And they released the audio after that. And I think that made a big impact.
So 2D line on the boot.
Check complete. Check complete. It's fine. Perfect.
Yeah. Off.
Thank you, mate. Wait. Onfield decision was offside. Are you happy with this?
Offside.
Onfield
decision. Goal. Yeah.
What? The image we gave you is onside.
Left back.
He's played. He's gone offside.
It was a bit of an unstructured chat. And I think people realised that perhaps you could bring a little bit more structure into some of these decisions and that might help.
And there's this fabled phrase now, isn't it? The margin of error. What does that mean when it's compared to VAR? I guess in practice, some of it comes down to these lines, the much controversial lines that are drawn on a slow motion replay to adjudicate whether a player is or is not offside. And we hear, oh, he's a toenail offside or an armpit offside. I mean, as a football fan, are you of the belief that the advantage should be given to the attacking team?
So I think this has been the huge issue with offside. And I think the offside, the controversies over offside have been, for me, the most unexpected aspect of VAR. I was always slightly dubious that it would work with things like fouls and handballs because they are quite subjective. But offside seemed like a tailor-made case for technological improvement because it just feels binary. You're either offside or you're not. And in fact, it's arguably been the most controversial aspect of VAR. For the last 20, 30 years, the offside rule has gradually been liberalised in favour of the attacker. And I think that has made for a better game. It's made it harder for teams to play the offside trap and it's kind of stretched play. And so I actually think what's made some of these offside decisions so controversial is the way they've reversed that 30-year trend, which I think most people are probably quite on board with. And it's introduced, it's probably made it a little bit more defence-friendly. And it's ruled out some goals, which I think probably would have in the previous few decades. But obviously, you do have to have an offside line somewhere. Whatever technology you use, a human eye, a camera, however good the frame rates, there does have to be a line. And someone is always going to be marginally one side of that line and marginally the other.
Isn't it, as a wider point, just the truth that technological advances in all sport are inevitable and technology is going to continue to interact with sport just as automation and big data is continuing to play more and more of a role in our own day-to-day lives?
I do think that, and I put forward some more advanced technological solutions in the book. I think the point I'm making is VAR's a dead end. I don't think you will have something very similar to VAR in 20 years' time. As I say, maybe you'll go back to base and have nothing. I agree with you, that's probably unlikely. But I think you'll end up with something that looks very different. I think football's authorities need to start thinking a bit more radically.
That is the author, Daisy Christodoulou, and her book, I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR, is out now.
I could do a 20-minute pub conversation, but a whole book on VAR?
Well, we spoke for almost 45 minutes when we spoke.
And I can well believe it.
I've got to tell you as well, Simon and Emma, I read quite a lot of sport books. Not many of them start with a Tennyson poem as an epigraph, but this one does, and it is a thoroughly good read.
There you go.
Thanks very much, Mike. Let's hear from Nikki Beattie ahead of this morning's Saturday Live.
Morning all. Our Saturday Live guests today are chef, restaurateur and storyteller Rick Stein, former DJ and musician, one half of Groove Armada, in fact, Andy Cato. He's now championing regenerative farming, and the indomitable Lady Anne Glenconner, witness to royal history, chronicler of British aristocracy and gay icon. All that, plus the inheritance tracks of wildlife presenter and writer Kate Humble. If you'd like to be in touch with us, email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk and we'll be with you just after the news at 9.
Looking forward to that, always am. Let's have a look at the weather. A largely cloudy day for much of the UK. If you were listening earlier, you'll understand why. Only brighter in some northwestern areas. And we spoke to the part of Scotland where we could rely on that.
It's 23 minutes to 9. You're listening today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Simon Jack and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The senior US Democrat Nancy Pelosi has suggested President Biden is partly to blame for his party's election defeat to Donald Trump, as Pelosi says Mr. Biden should have pulled out of the presidential race sooner. Tehran has rejected US allegations of an Iranian plot to assassinate Mr. Trump, calling them baseless and malicious. The US Justice Department has charged a man it says was told to make a plan to kill Mr. Trump by Iran's Revolutionary Guards. At least 25 people have been killed in a bombing at a railway station in western Pakistan. A separatist group says it carried out the attack. A DNA testing firm appears to have ceased trading without telling its customers what's happened to the highly sensitive data that they shared with it. The website of Atlas Biomed no longer works, and the firm's last update on social media was over a year ago. And more than 30 firefighters, police officers and other public servants who died in the line of duty have become the first to posthumously receive a new award in recognition of their sacrifice. The Elizabeth emblem will be given to the recipients' families.
Thanks very much indeed, Alan. What does the second coming of Donald Trump mean for the US and the rest of the world? How should, how will people who consider themselves liberal, centrist, feminist respond to his emphatic win in the world's most powerful democracy? And does his re-election challenge the international rules-based order any more this time than it did last time around? I've been speaking to the historian Sir Simon Sharma and Timothy Garton Ash, historian and author of Homelands, A Personal History of Europe, about whether we are at the end of a liberal rules-based world order. But first, I asked Simon Sharma why we were even asking this question at all, whether it's a question that's only being asked by liberals who don't like that Donald Trump won an election.
The news are hungry for the next thing. I mean, they thrive on manufactured drama. You could say, however much you hated the result, I couldn't possibly have hated it more. Democracy actually worked in America. Nobody this time is suggesting that there was something kind of structurally, institutionally wrong with it. So the answer to really whether or not this is a real sea change will come with actually how Trump's government works. For instance, will he be able to fire, and possibly he may, federal employees at will because they're insufficiently political loyal? So we won't really find out until the government has had some time. The only other thing I'd say is that if you actually look at Poland, if you look at the Balts, they're not just going to kind of lie down or fall down like kind of spent matchsticks, really. So the weakness of liberal democracy is as weak as we decide to panic over. Mm. I don't know if Tim feels the same way.
Why do we think that Trump 2.0 will be any different than Trump 1.0, which was followed by a Biden-Harris administration? So it was not as if it was the end of democracy or the end of people voting for the Democrats in the US. Timothy?
No.
Because Trump 2.0 has learned from the failures of Trump 1.0 when he was surrounded by so-called grown-ups who restrained him. I think the threat to liberal democracy in the United States is a bit more serious than that. He will potentially control both Congress, the House and the Senate, and the presidency, and have a very sympathetic Supreme Court. So the separation of powers is quite weakened, and he has a plan, as Simon said, you know, to politicize the whole bureaucracy and further undermine the rule of law. So I think that there is, you know, there is a task to be done in defending the Republic and defending liberal democracy more broadly. But as Simon rightly says, Poland is a wonderful example of a country which, where democracy was very seriously undermined. It was halfway to Viktor Orban's Hungary, which is no longer a democracy. But then they turned it around.
Okay. And just for the rest of the world, Simon Sharma, hasn't Trump got a point? Isn't it time that, you know, NATO looked after itself a little bit, you know, that European countries with Russia on its on their eastern front should be paying to look after themselves? And if we have to pull up our socks in our own defence, that's no bad thing.
Trump has also said, actually, which of course his acolytes will say was done in a humorous moment, that his approach to NATO is not unlike that of a mob boss. He sees it transactionally. As a kind of quid pro quo, you pay up for your protection. And, you know, that kind of understanding of what NATO is about, actually, a kind of exchange and mart understanding, is catastrophic. And he has promised, of course, this is the first of the promises, which I think both Tim and I will confidently say will not be fulfilled, to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. I mean, if that's achieved, it's otherwise called a capitulation.
Well, I was going to ask that question. If you basically draw the lines, or the new lines on the map where the current battlefield lines are drawn, does that amount to appeasement? What is the danger there?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it's exactly that. It would be absolutely staggering after all this horrific sacrifice of lives. Zelensky. Did you notice that actually Elon Musk was on a phone call that Trump made to Zelensky? It's profoundly sinister, mitigated only by idiotic incompetence, really. Elon Musk is also someone who's claimed he can cut $2 trillion from the federal budget, which is more than the departments of defense, education, and homeland security combined. So they may think they're masters of the universe in their particular AI world, but governing is a completely different thing. And NATO is based on the honorable combined defense of democracy. It's been the greatest and most successful military alliance in the modern period. So that's not going to happen.
Timothy, are we not already in a post-Western world in many ways, with China, Russia, for example, changing the polarity of international politics?
Yes, I think we are. So there are a couple of things going on here. One is Trump, who is, thank God, unique, but that matters. The second is that there's been a trend for at least 20 years since George W. Bush of diminishing U.S. commitment to an interest in Europe. And that's going to be turbocharged under Donald Trump. He's not going to support Ukraine. We can't totally rely on him to defend Europe in NATO. And he's certainly not going to defend the liberal international order. His America for the next 4 years is going to be nationalist, protectionist, and transactional. We in Britain, in Europe, like-minded countries like Canada and Australia, we have to support Ukraine starting January 20th. We have to do more for our own defense. And I totally agree, 80 years after the end of the Second World War, that's a quite reasonable suggestion that we should defend ourselves. We have to defend the liberal order. But we're going to have to do that in a world where power has massively shifted to major non-Western great and middle powers, China, a superpower, India, Russia, Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, and all of them actually behave like 19th century European great powers. They calmly pursue their national interests. They're entirely transactional. They are, as it were, if you like, geopolitical swingers. They'll sleep with anybody when it suits their interests with Russia.
Well,
China
on
another.
On that racy note, can I just say, Simon Sharma, a final thought? If you are of your mind, the good news for you is that you can vote for somebody else on 4 years, and because he can only serve two terms and would need a special majority in both houses of Congress to change that, it's a 4 year thing.
The Constitutional Amendment, he needs 2/3 majority in both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the states of the United States, so that ain't going to happen.
All right, on that note, thank you both indeed, very much indeed. Simon Sharma, Timothy Garton-Ash, thank you both.
And of course, tonight, let's turn our attention to baby formula, because whether the NHS should create its own branded form of baby milk to help women afford a trusted breast milk substitute if they're struggling to feed their babies or cannot or do not want to breastfeed. That is a question, and it's a suggestion from the interim report from the Competition and Markets Authority looking into the very expensive baby formula market. Just to put it in context, prices for formula in the UK have jumped between 18 and 36%, depending on the brand, over a two-year period. Chris Van Tulleken is a doctor, professor and author, but also an advisor to the World Health Organization in this area. Maxine Palmer is head of service development at the National Childbirth Trust. Chris, if I could come to you first of all, good morning. There's some interesting suggestions in this. It is an interim report. People may not know that it's the situation with formula is that they're not allowed to promote the brands that make it with price reductions or deals so as not to discourage breastfeeding. And one of the recommendations here is the ban on price promotions should be overturned. Where do you stand on that?
Well, it's a pretty good report, actually, and it's built on a lot of data by First Steps Nutrition, who are one of the very few charities in the UK that aren't funded by the food or formula industry. And the only point in the report, actually, that I think a lot of global and national experts take exception to is this idea of reducing the promotions. And the reason is this, that when you make a decision to start your child on formula, you're at one of the most vulnerable moments of your life. And if there is a promotion on a particular brand, that might save you up to £500 a year. But you can't guarantee that promotion is going to continue for the 6 months to a year that you'll be using the formula, and it may become unaffordable. So what we see is an obscene disparity in pricing, where you can spend £7 at one supermarket today on an 800-gram tin, or £22 on a different brand. And so we have very, very weak regulation actually in the UK around how we should, around protecting the marketing. So actually the promotions, restricting the promotions is really important. You shouldn't be able to do temporary price promotions on formula. But most of the recommendations in this report are extremely solid.
And for you then, just going to the one you think that might make a difference to the way this whole industry works, what's the one that you would really like to see enacted?
The most important thing is that we bring the World Health Organization code about the marketing of breast milk substitutes, infant formula, that we bring that into UK law. Lots of countries have done that. It is a fantastically well-evidenced public health document. And so one of the really important things that would bring in is really tight marketing restrictions. The other suggestion in the report is a price cap, and that's pretty sensible. So the idea of NHS formula, what's important to say to any parent listening is all formula is nutritionally comparable. So that £7 800 gram tin is functionally identical for your child as the £22 tin at another supermarket.
That's the other concern, isn't it? People get taken in by the way that marketing works and think that they need to spend the most.
Everyone thinks that, you know, I've fed my kids formula, and you think you buy the pro combiotic comfort advanced anti-reflux formula for three times the price as an identical product or a nutritionally identical product. So in a way, those formulas branded as advanced or with health claims, the European Food Safety Authority has said that the additional ingredients in them may place a burden on infant metabolism. If there is an ingredient that works, it would be mandatory in all formula. And if there's an ingredient that isn't mandatory, I would not buy that formula.
And just on the idea of an NHS, very quickly, an NHS milk, what do you make of that?
I think these things are all about the technical implementation, but that is basically a pretty sensible idea. Formula is an essential food. And parents have a real lack of access.
And taking the branding out of it. Maxine, as head of service development at the National Childbirth Trust, I wonder if you're going to come at this in perhaps a slightly different way or looking at it from where we are with feeding.
I think our perspective is that we just see absolutely this crisis in support for parents because of the issues in maternity services. And their workforce crisis, and that means that parents aren't getting timely support when they need it. And one of the areas that this influences most is actually postnatal care, when parents, as Chris has just said, you know, can be incredibly vulnerable and making decisions that they're stressed, often stressed decisions. They're not when they've got good quality information around them, and they're often making quick decisions based on the influence of marketing.
So what would you say specifically on this issue? Because that's huge what you've raised, and it is a massive issue in the NHS. In fact, it's one of the areas that they regularly, in reports, authors say, you know, is almost the unsolvable, the lack of postnatal care.
But to come specifically to
breast milk substitute, what do you make of this?
Well, what we make of this and the way in which we operate as a charity is that we know that there is a huge information gap for parents. And so we think it's incredibly important that high quality information is out there and accessible to parents. But most importantly, that it's available antenatally. They really need this information before they have to make any decisions about how they feed their baby. And we feel that this really important message is getting lost, and particularly that message that Chris just shared about that all formulas meet their baby's nutritional needs. It really does get lost through the influence of formula milk branding and marketing. And it can really lead new parents to spend much more money than they need to.
And I suppose, though, there are certain rules that we were just discussing that are in place because the concern around promoting formula feeding over breastfeeding. There is a culture around that and concerns around that. Where do you stand on that as the NCT?
Well, again, the place we stand is that we know that we want to be there for every parent, so that we provide information on all forms of infant feeding, and we provide it in a parent-centered way that's evidence-based and that's impartial and without bias, so that we can empower people to make decisions that feel right for them and their families in their particular set of circumstances.
No, but I'm just trying to ask, are you this idea of we can't have regulation, you can't have promotions, price reductions or deals so as not to discourage breastfeeding. Do you want that to continue?
Well, price promotions won't help parents with the security they need of a stable price for an essential foodstuff. So at the moment, there's such a range of prices that parents could pay, and it really, given that it could make up to £500 difference a year, parents need to know that A, they can go into a supermarket or a chemist and actually be able to, there's a good supply of the formula that they've chosen and decided to feed their baby. But they also need to know
that the prices
are going to suddenly have doubled.
James, I suppose what I was also driving at, but we've slightly run out of time, is the culture around how we promote or don't promote breastfeeding as well, which has dictated some of these rules historically. But we'll have to come back to that. Maxine Palmer, Chris Van Tulleken, thank you.
Now, yesterday we spoke on this programme to the former head of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, about Vladimir Putin praising Trump as a real man who acted courageously when a gunman tried to assassinate him, and said Moscow was ready for dialogue with him. Here's Sir Alex Younger.
I think this is classic spy bluster, and, you know, I should know. Putin has access to the best psychologists. I would have thought very carefully about how to send the most manipulative and flattering message he can manage.
Well, he should know, as you said, former head of MI6. But let's speak to Dr. Kenneth DeClaver, psychiatrist who previously worked at the US Embassy in Moscow and specialises in leadership analysis, political psychology. Does this have all the hallmarks of professional mind games to you?
Yes, Sir Alex is correct. It's both a combination of professional kind of spy games by Putin, who is, of course, a trained KGB officer, and as he described in his memoir, First Person, a student of human relations. He also has what Russians call chustvitelnost, their Germans call fingerspitzengefühl, which is a sensitivity to these kind of things. But the other important thing besides his praise of Trump as a real man, mujesveni chelovyek, a mushina, a man's man, is that Putin is showing respect, and it's something he expects from other leaders, including President Trump, which is a mutual respect of him as the leader of a superpower, a UN Permanent Five power. This is something that he craves, and in a public forum like Valdai, where Putin spoke, it's something that Russians crave. So his message actually not only will likely resonate with President Trump, but also with ordinary Russians.
Is he exploiting what some have described as President Trump's narcissism? Is there a bit of mutual narcissism going on here? Because I understand that you did a profile of Putin yourself.
Yeah, yes. All all politicians are narcissists, so these terms aren't really that helpful. Certainly he's appealing to President Trump's ego, his vanity, his sense of who he is. But what's really important is that what he wants here is that respect begets respect. And I think President Trump intuitively understands that. They both, former President Medvedev and President Putin, spoke of Trump as being a businessman, as someone rational. The implicit, this is the ironic statement, because it's what the late Margaret Thatcher said about Gorbachev, someone we can do business with. And Putin intuitively understands this. So I think this is very important. Putin is also a fabulous student of history, and he should pay attention to the history, because the last time the then USSR dealt with two great Western leaders, Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, who were both willing to take a bullet, their later subsequent political behaviors changed the course of history.
We're going to have, and on that note, changing the course of history, we'll leave it there. Dr. Kenneth De Klaver, thank you very much indeed for that profile of mind games, geopolitical mind games.
Oh, yeah. Course of changing history. That's all from us. Our editors today, Tom Fielden and Joshua Sells. Studio director, Adrian Bhargava. After the news, Saturday Live. But before we go, I'm thrilled to be able to say we're going to end the programme with Beyoncé. I can't always say that. She's made history as the most Grammy-nominated artist ever. Her first nomination for Bills, 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 loved it, when she was in her girl group trio Destiny's Child. This year, just in, her 99th nomination for her album Cowboy Carter, which personally I adored, perhaps you did. In what is perhaps an even bigger honour, though, of course, she's also one of the most mentioned artists on our own Desert Island Discs. Here's Jimmy Carr, Sheryl Sandberg, Annie Nightingale on their best Beyoncé hits.
Tell me about your 8th disc, Jimmy Carr. What are we going to hear?
I think this is maybe the best pop record ever. It's a really upbeat love song, and most love songs, especially on this show, are quite melancholy. There's a lot of ache, and I'm not a big fan of the ache. I'm a big fan of the fun, joyous party. So this is, yeah, Beyoncé Crazy in Love.
A few years ago, she did the Ban Bossy campaign with me. And if you ask crowds of people, men, raise your hand if you've been called bossy as a little boy. Two hands go up. Women, raise your hand if you were called bossy as a little girl. Every hand goes up. And that's because no matter what the cultural differences are for women all over the world, we expect men to lead and women to do for others. And so Beyoncé's message that women can run the world, that women should run the world, her message that she's the boss, I think is super important for not just women, but little girls and boys to hear. Girls run the world.
Well, we're obviously, I've had this long career. I've witnessed changes in music, which have been incredibly exciting. And one of the biggest step changes ever was rap and how that took over America and the world and has brought about people who've become so important.